Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient.
Alright, alright, alright. Hey, good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here on WGN. It is a Tuesday morning. That means two for Tuesday. Yeah, baby, two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200, one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Every morning on the show, you guys pick and program the music bumps that we hear coming out of the news and the breaks, and we have different themes every day. Today's two for Tuesday, 312-981-7200. Hey, coming up on the show in just a couple of minutes, our good friend Tom Appel is going to join us for his monthly visit. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. You can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And you can check out the blog at consumerguide.com. He will answer any and all of your automotive or car-related questions. Looking to get a car, looking to get some advice, he can help you out. And we also have a bunch of car and automotive-related stories to talk about and reviews of cars as well. Always a lot of fun when Tom is here, and so always very informative as well. And again, if you have any automotive or car-related question, you need some advice, you need some help, 312-981-7200. Just a couple of minutes, he'll be here. You can text or call us with your questions at 312-981-7200. So Tom's going to be hanging out here, and we are going to be talking about some of the most expensive movie memorabilia of all time. We're going to talk about things that every Chicagoan should know, because I love talking about this city, because I've never lived any place else ever. Never in the suburbs, never always in the city. I've lived in Chicago my entire life. 54 years I've lived in this city, and I love it. Vic mentioned it during the news that this black cat ran out on the field during the during the Monday night football game, and it's pretty entertaining. So we're going to play that back, talk a little bit about that. And there's a history of animals interrupting sporting events. There's a pretty rich history of animals interrupting sporting events, so we're going to talk about that as well. Does Christmas come too early? We might get to that a little bit later. I think it does. That's just me. I live kind of across the street from a Walgreens, and the Christmas stuff was up before Halloween. the Christmas aisle already up. They didn't even take the Christmas. The Halloween stuff wasn't even down yet. The candy wasn't even half price. So, nuts. Anyway, so that's what's up on the show this morning. If you want to call us or join us with anything and automotive or car-related questions, it's 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show, and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. If you can't listen live, subscribe to our podcast. Lots of people do, and we thank you for that. Some people can't be up between 1 and 5 a.m., so they get the podcast, they subscribe, and they listen at their leisure, bro. It's easy to do. It's free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, or go to WGNRadio.com, subscribe to the podcast. Every single second of every single show is podcast, and it's free. Subscribe. It'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So that's what's happening on this Tuesday morning. Let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, did you have a good birthday?
I did have a good birthday. Yeah. It was nice. My girlfriend got me a cake.
Oh.
Probably too much cake. She went a little bit overboard on it, but it was very nice, and we just made a nice dinner. Made some bratwurst, and that was nice. And I watched Fury
with Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
Brad Pitt. That's a good movie.
I was surprised at how much I liked it.
It's also a very violent movie.
Yeah, a cut above, I would say, most World War II movies. Very good. Not great, yeah. But I thought it was incredibly entertaining.
It did not do well at the box office. Like, nobody went to see it, and I actually thought it was solid. I liked it. Very violent, though. That's the thing. I was kind of surprised at just how violent it was.
Yeah, and I appreciated that it didn't shy away from showing that sometimes, war gets to people and they do things that they wouldn't normally
right.
do. But the performances were incredible. I was mm-hmm. shocked at how much I enjoyed everybody in that movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of Brad Pitt. I always have been.
Big fan of Brad Pitt's haircut.
Yeah.
Fury.
He's got
very
impressive,
trendsetting.
Impressive. So there you go. Well, I'm glad you had a good birthday. Let's go into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Doing just fine.
Good. Did you see the black cat running around?
I did watch it.
Isn't that hilarious?
On your recommendation. Yeah, it's good. The players' reactions are good, too. They look very confused.
Yeah, they did. I just liked who's the play-by-play on Monday Night Football?
Oh, my God. I can't think of it.
Because his play-by-play of the cat was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. He was calling it as he got
so
close
funny.
To me.
Do we have some of that? Let's play a little bit of that, because we're going to talk about the history of animals interrupting sporting events a little bit later on. But this is pretty classic. It's online right now. You got to see the video. It's really funny. From the game last night. What do we got?
Well, there's a cat. A black cat is taking the field. A black cat is running from the 20 to the near side, the 10. From the 39 in Dallas, here's a short throw down the middle, caught by Ingram. Caught at the 35, went to the 30. Now the cat running the other way. And so is Ingram at the 30 to the 25, to the 24-yard line of the Dallas Cowboys. It's a catch and run of 15. Now the cat is stopped at the 50. And the cat is in the CDW red zone. CDW, people who get it now, a policeman, a state trooper has come on the field. And the cat runs into the end zone. That is a touchdown.
Oh, man. The footage is hilarious. It really is funny. So we're going to talk about that. Now, have you ever seen, you've seen that, Vic, you've seen like animals get on the field in other situations?
Sure.
In sporting events?
Squirrels, yeah. Cats, birds.
I particularly like it around about 4:30 or 4:30 p.m. at Wrigley when the seagulls just invade. There's seagulls everywhere. Right around that time around the summer, around 4:00, 4:30, that's when the seagulls decide, okay, we're going to Wrigley and we're gonna watch a baseball game.
And the announcer was Kevin Harlan.
Kevin Harlan, okay. Kevin Harlan. Nice job, my friend. Very funny. And of course the infamous black cat that cursed the 1969 Cubs. Ron Santo hated that cat. Yeah. That's probably the most famous, in Chicago sports history. That's got to be the most famous animal interference in a sports related in a sports game. I mean, the most legendary, because of course it gave Cub fans another excuse to say that they're cursed. Hey, that curse was lifted 3 years ago, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
3 years ago.
2 days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I really still.
The parade was the parade was 3 years ago today. Like 5 million people showed up.
Yeah. I remember the night that they won, I literally sprinted to the red line in Rogers Park and got down to Wrigley. I was like, I got to be there.
Yeah. I had to work that night. And so I watched it at home. And first thing I did, of course, when they won the World Series, I called my father. You know, my dad's been a Cub fan his entire life. You know? And, yeah, so, but he got to see a World Series win. But, so it was pretty amazing. And then I was on the air after that. Dan and I came down and basically we talked about the Cubs for the entire show. You know, people who were there called in and all that stuff. Andy Mazur actually fell out of his chair and collapsed when they won.
I wish I could have seen that.
He was in the studio that we used to use. Well, I used to use on the seventh floor across the river in the Trib building, and it's set up almost exactly like this one, which is why I use this studio and not A. I like the Studio D because it's set up almost exactly like the seventh floor studio in the Trib building. And he was sitting in the chair that's to my right, like the second host chair. Because there's the main host chair that I'm sitting in right now, and then there's a second host chair. He was sitting in that chair, fell out. fell out of the chair, almost passed out when the Cubs won the World Series. So, all right. Well, that was a fun time. All right, well, Vic's in the newsroom. He's in there all morning long, and Tom is producing, and I am your host. And we've got a ton of other stuff we're going to be talking about, more animal-interrupting sporting events. We've got the most expensive movie memorabilia, everything that a Chicagoan should know. And when we come back from the break, Tom Appel will be here, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, for his monthly visit to talk everything car and automotive related. If you have any car or automotive concerns or questions, call us right now at 312-981-7200. Tom is live and here to help if you got any concerns or questions. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio. 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Tuesday. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in. We'll play them later. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. All right. Every month we talk with Tom Appel. He's a publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He can answer any and all of your automotive or car-related questions, so text them or call them in it right now at 312-981-7200. You can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And let's say hello to Tom. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. How you been?
Really good. Thank you.
Good, good, good. Tell everybody about, as we always do, Consumer Guide Automotive.
Yeah, we've been around way back since 1967, but we review all things automotive, new and used, at consumerguide.com. We try to have some fun with what's going on in the car world. That's our blog. That's the CG Daily Drive blog. You can go directly there or just go through consumerguide.com. You can get there either way.
There you go. And Tom joins us. He's kind enough to join us once a month. We have a lot of fun conversations and news conversations about cars. And then if anybody has any questions or looking to get a car or need some answers about car or automotive stuff, it's 312-981-7200. I always ask you, Tom, what have you been driving lately?
Oh, wow. You know what I just drove is a car that I practically forgot existed. It is the Jaguar XE, which is Jaguar's compact sedan. It's sort of a competitor for the BMW 3 Series, but it's been a fairly slow seller, and that's kind of a bummer because it's a nice little car. A little bit too small for me, but reasonably priced in that field of cars against the 3 Series BMW, the Volvo, sort of the S60, but the compact sports sedan field. I liked it a lot. I thought it rode and handled really well. The interior was nicely outfitted. It felt like a luxury car, but it's just a little bit anonymous, and I think Jaguar styling might be just a little too dull these days to get noticed.
Oh, okay. And what else have you driven since the last time we talked?
I'm currently driving the all-new Subaru Legacy. That's Subaru's midsize sedan, in a segment that no one talks about anymore. This is a pretty nice car. People probably know that all Subarus are all-wheel drive. That's kind of their trademark thing. But this is a roomy car. It rides well. It feels good. So far, I like it a lot. It has a new infotainment system with a much bigger screen that's easier to use as a touchscreen. Big improvement over previous Subarus.
Mm, okay, great. What else have other guys been driving around in the office?
Right now, our guy Damon is in the S60 plug-in hybrid.
Oh.
I don't know what it is with luxury automakers, but all hybrids are now plug-in hybrids.
Wow.
And we're doing that. And it's an interesting thing because you get 15, 20, or 30 miles of EV range, and then the gasoline engine kicks in, and it just sort of works like a hybrid. I hope people are plugging these cars in because they're much better if you do, but they do work as hybrids otherwise. But so far, so good. I think he's getting great mileage with that because he lives pretty close to the office, so he's not really using a lot of gas.
Okay. And so what happens when the hybrid part kicks in? Is there like a sudden jolt in the car?
Actually, it depends on the car, and Volvo engines are not the smoothest in the world, so yeah, there probably is a noticeable jolt, and it's not as quiet as it had been operating on pure electric power.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Do you like driving the electric cars?
I love electric cars. I love pure electric cars. They're very quick. I just drove the The Nissan Leaf Plus, which is a long-range version of the Nissan Leaf. And it, because it has a bigger battery, it's just a little bit quicker. And it's a zippy car. And they're deceptively quiet because there's no engine noise whatsoever, which is interesting because you have this sort of eerie atmosphere, but you can hear the road because the engine, when it runs, sort of has a sound-canceling effect. So you hear different things when you drive an electric car.
That's weird.
It is kind of weird, yeah. It's hard to think that when a gasoline engine is running, it muffles out other sounds, but it really does.
Yeah, wow, that must be a little strange.
It's a little bit eerie, yeah. You hear gravel, you hear tire noise you don't usually hear.
Yeah.
But in general, they're quieter.
Okay. All right. If you guys have any questions or concerns here, automotive or car related, text or call us at 312-981-7200. Tom, we have a call here from our friend Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Nick and Mr. Rappel. Hey, a general question. I'm 63 years old, kind of wasn't driving totally in the muscle car era, but listening to you guys talk, and I've gone back and looked on the Consumer Guide website at old car ads, and I've noticed that car manufacturers never advertised horsepower as real horsepower. You know, you'd get like a 427 Chevy that'd say 290 horsepower, and now you got the big three, Ford, Chevy, and Chrysler, bragging about 900, 700, 800 horsepower cars. What's the difference between then and now?
Well, one of the things that happened is that the horsepower, the development of the engine was completely stunted by the onset of emission controls. So we had the malaise era, which was sort of from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. And it was a period of time where manufacturers simply could not keep pace with emission controls, and power suffered and fuel economy suffered. But since then, really, as fuel injection has gotten better and better, and engine efficiency has gotten better, and engine durability has gotten better, horsepower numbers have just climbed to ceiling numbers. And yeah, you now have red-eye Hemi Hellcat things that get close to 900 horsepower.
Jeez.
And you have big diesel pickups that are cranking out 900 or 1,000 pound-feet of torque. But those are legitimate numbers. Those are actually slightly understated relative to the numbers from the muscle car era because they used a different system in those days.
Wow.
Yeah, because, like, I remember one ad I've seen. I think I found it on Consumer Guide. It compared, like, the Torinos with 429 and 428, you know, Cobra jets. And it showed a two-barrel having more horsepower than the four-barrel 428, you know, and it's like, are they just trying to fool the insurance regulators? And if so, you know,
well, you know, what's, that's a very real thing. Beginning in 1973, manufacturers did try to fool the insurance regulators.
Wow.
So there were all sorts of different versions of engines that they were sort of sneaking in under the radar, slightly smaller. And like you said, there were two barrels instead of four barrels and stuff like that. And I think that they were sandbagging the horsepower numbers because it was getting more difficult to insure those cars.
Wow. Oh, that's right. Interesting. All right, Rich. Thanks.
All right.
Yep, take care.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. There you go. Oh, that's interesting. My dad used to have a Torino.
Yeah, I knew a lot of people at Torinos. For some reason, there were people running around Friend High School when I was a kid wearing Torino T-shirts. It was a popular car for some reason.
Yeah, no, my dad, we had a red Torino, and my dad used to gun that thing. So, let's see. We got a quick text here before we break for the news here, Tom. Recently, my 2011 Ford Fiesta was totaled in a crash. Oh. I loved the car, except for the transmission problems. Has Ford made improvements in later models?
No, and they've also discontinued the car.
So there you go.
Yeah, if you're looking for a used Fiesta, it's probably going to feel pretty much like the transmission problem you thought you had.
Okay, clear enough. All right,
yeah.
There you go. So, yeah, why is there? Have they ever pinpointed why there's a transmission problem in those cars?
Well, the problem was almost more consumer reaction to the transmission than the transmission itself. It was a double-clutch transmission, which is a very aggressive and sporty thing, and I think that if they were selling it to enthusiasts, there would be no complaints. But the Fiesta, and it was in the Focus as well, these were high-volume cars going to fairly mainstream buyers, all of whom I think were disappointed by the shift quality.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right, Tom, hang on, okay?
Will do.
Tom Appel is with us. He's great, and he is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. You can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom, and he can answer any and all of your automotive questions if you have them at 312-981-7200. Talk and text. We'll get back to the conversation after the news. My little news scoop, you don't know what I got. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. I'm your overnight dude here every weekday morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Thank you all for listening and for the support. And check us out, 312-981-7200. So we're going to talk more about animals interrupting sporting events because the hilarious moment last night during the Monday Night Football game of the black cat running around on the football field. We'll get to that. We're going to talk about really expensive movie memorabilia and everything, things that every Chicagoan should know. So that's all coming up on the show. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And it's 2 for Tuesday, so get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. Joining us now for our monthly visit is Tom Appel from Consumer Guide Automotive, here to talk cars and automotive-related stuff and answer your questions at 312-981-7200. Tom, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, you guys featured five of the worst-selling cars of 2019. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is these are not the absolute worst sellers, but they are bad sellers. And these were vehicles that kind of surprised me that they were selling poorly. And I think that their poor sales are sort of indicative of problems on the horizon for those manufacturers, or at least for those vehicles.
And which ones? What are the five?
Okay, we have the Buick Regal. We have the Fiat 500L, specifically the L, the Genesis G90, the Jaguar XF. All of those are just they're probably things you've heard of, and they're selling very poorly. And the Regal is really an interesting one, too, because Buick redesigned the Regal, and everyone knows that name. That was once a very popular model in the Buick lineup. But it's a midsize sedan, and sedans just don't sell well now, and Buick has moved on to crossovers. So Buick took the Regal, and they redesigned it, and it's not even really a sedan now. There's an Outback-like off-road-looking wagon called the Tourx, and then the thing that looks most like a sedan is actually a hatchback called a Sportback. But despite sort of nodding towards things crossover, Buick can't give these things away.
Wow.
It's a shame because it's actually a very nice car.
What are some of the other reasons why these cars aren't going? So why is the Fiat not selling?
Fiat's a big problem, I think, for FCA. That's Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. I think it was a mistake to bring in the Fiat brand to the U.S. just in general.
Uh-huh.
I think people who remember the Fiat brand from the last time it was here back in the 80s didn't have a very good feeling for it. And they brought in a brand, and then they decided to sell it through independent franchises as opposed to through Fiat. Either through Chrysler or Dodge or Jeep dealers, which are all together now. So there are fewer dealers. It's a strange name, and people just didn't warm up to it.
Yeah. What about the Genesis?
The Genesis is interesting. It's a very nice car. Genesis is the luxury arm of Hyundai, and they've spun this car off, and the G90, large car, and the G80, more or less mid-sized car, were the first vehicles under the Genesis brand. And then there was just some confusion about how they were going to sell these, and there were some arguments between the Hyundai management and Hyundai dealers, all of whom wanted to sell these luxury cars, but Hyundai wanted separate franchises. So what they decided to do was sell some of the Genesis products through any dealers, but the G90 was exclusively available through Genesis dealers. And because it took them so long to roll out these dealers, the G90 was virtually unavailable in many markets. So it was just a very strange situation, and now I think it's kind of forgotten.
Oh, man. What about the Jaguar?
I don't know what's going on with the Jaguar. Jaguar's just having a hard time overall, but the XF, which is their mid-sized car, kind of competes with the BMW 5 Series and the Mercedes-Benz E-Class, is selling very poorly. I think Jaguar styling has gotten a little bit anonymous. I'm not sure this car's 100% competitive in terms of drivetrain offerings or technology or even safety equipment with some of the German brands, but it is languishing, and they're selling almost none of these things right now.
Oh, all right. A couple of texts here, Tom.
Yeah.
When are car companies going to cut out the smartphone middleman and attach a 4G antenna to their vehicles? As soon as my car gets its own dedicated podcast app, I'm going back to the flip phone.
I didn't understand that question at all. What? Because the 4G is available on some cars. Did I miss the question?
Winter car. They're going to cut out the smartphone middleman and attach a 4G. Well, they already have, right?
Yeah, in some cases. I mean, General Motors OnStar has been around forever and is not dependent on a phone. So there is that. I think most people would prefer to go through their phone because that way they're not setting up separate accounts for a lot of the things that they're attached to.
Mm.
I don't think you're going to see a car go specifically cellular on its own, at least not for some telematic functions. In fact, it's been going the other direction.
Okay. Mark in Utah says, Tom, everyone knows that the 1988 Ford turbocharged Thunderbird was the hottest, sexiest car ever. And so were the men who drove them. Why did Ford dump the turbocharger? I'm assuming Mark drove one. That would be my guess, Tom.
Yeah, you know what? In the day, the Ford Turbo Coupe was the Thunderbird Turbo Coupe was in fact totally badass.
Yeah,
it was a very cool car. Little hood gills and the turbocharged 2.3. You could get it with a manual transmission. Really good looking wheels. The reason they passed on that because that engine was actually nasty as hell. It was loud. It vibrated. It made all sorts of noise, and it wasn't especially reliable. So Ford moved on to the next generation of the car to a supercharged V6 that was slightly less nasty. But ultimately, the Thunderbird proved to be a difficult thing to sell.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that's Thunderbird.
That's one of my favorite texts that we've ever had, I think. Here's Christina on WGN. Hi, Christina.
Oh, my feet are just killing me. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I bought a 2014 Toyota Scion IQ a few years back. And I had a flat tire one winter, and with those cars, there was no spare. There was no spare. They have a little kit. You're probably familiar with it, where it's like a chemical, and it comes with a little compressor, and you put that into your tire like you're filling it up with air, and the chemical kind of seals it from the inside. So what I read in the manual is that once that happens, that it kind of sets off, and it kind of disengages the tire alert. What is it called? The little flashing thing that tells you that one of your tires needs air.
Yes, yeah, the TPMS, tire pressure monitoring system.
Okay, so that's been going on for a couple of years now. I just didn't know if that was. I mean, I check my tire pressure almost every week. Everything's fine, but I was just wondering, do you know what that would cost to get it repaired, and do I need to go to a dealer to get it done? Because none of these oil Jiffy Lube guys, they didn't want to mess with it.
You may have to go to a dealer. The system in the Scion IQ would have been a fairly simple system, and I think the thing was nothing more than a little register that worked with the Adelec brake system, if I'm thinking about the correct thing. So it should not be all that complicated to replace.
It's not a fuse that I could access, like a little fuse?
Oh, I don't think it's as simple as a fuse.
Okay,
Christina.
Can I ask one other question?
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So this is, I had my nephew in the car a few months back, and he was messing with the little, you know, the air conditioning, the vents, and he had stuck a pen that you write with, and he put it in there, and the thing fell down into the middle of the one of the vents, and I can't engage my defroster now, the little knob that you turn.
Oh.
Yeah, so I brought that into a mechanic, and he was, I don't know if he wasn't familiar with the car, but he said he needs to take the whole panel out.
Yeah, he might.
Oh, man.
$400 or $500 to fix that?
You may have to go deep in there to get it. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, that's kind of a network in the dash, and it's, yeah, that's labor intensive.
Man, never have your nephew in the car ever again.
No, he's banned.
Oh, okay.
That's it for him. He wrote his own.
take the bus from now on, kid.
That's right.
All right.
No more. No.
Christina,
thanks. Guys.
Okay,
thanks
take care.
So much.
That's a pain, man.
Yeah, you don't want to drop anything in there because it's really hard to work on that.
Oh, jeez. All right, here's another call. Ray is on the line. Hi, Ray.
Hello, Tom?
Yes. Yeah, go.
Yeah, I'm looking at a 2019 Ridgeline.
Uh-huh.
I'm just I'm 6 years old. I'll be using it for camping and traveling with my wife. Would that be a better pickup than the Ford Ranger? I'm looking for convenience and comfort when I drive.
Yes, the Honda Ridgeline is one of my favorite vehicles of all time, the current second generation of the Ridgeline. I love it. I would buy one myself. Everything about it is just really great. It's really a pickup version of the Honda Pilot with a wonderful huge trunk in the
bed itself. Yeah, I've seen that. It was beautiful, beautiful.
It's incredibly useful. I love that vehicle a lot. It's a little bit lighter duty than all the other medium mid-sized trucks, but if you're not going to haul a lot or tow a lot...
No.
It's my option.
Yeah. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Sounds good,
great,
Ray.
Great vehicle.
All right. Thanks, Ray.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. All right. Tom, we got a text here, which is kind of tied into the baby Bronco story that's on Consumer Guide.
Yeah.
Any news on the new Bronco, when it comes out, and if the rumors are true that it will have a manual transmission? Also, what about the next generation Frontier release date? That's from Luke.
Wow, two great pickup truck questions, or truck heavy duty, no, what's the word I'm looking for? Off roady truck questions. The Bronco, which is a more or less 4x4 version of the Ranger. It's going to be an SUV in the truest sense of the word. It's a body-on-frame, off-road ready vehicle. It's been teased by Ford now for something like 3 years, but we will see it this year. It's going to debut in 2020 as a 2021. So that's coming out soon. As for a manual transmission, I don't know. I hadn't heard that. It's possible, I guess, because off-roaders like them, but I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't going to be one. As for the Frontier, that is Nissan's compact midsize pickup truck, which hasn't been redesigned in something like 15 years. That is due for a redesign for the 2021 model year.
All right, there you go. Now, you guys wrote a piece about the baby Bronco. What's in a name? Tell me about that. The Bronco's been around for how many years?
Well, the Bronco disappeared for a long time, and it's coming back now after a long break for 2021, and it will again be a very serious off-road vehicle. It's sort of Ford's equivalent to the Toyota 4Runner, which is still selling very well for Toyota. The baby Bronco is sort of an inside name for a vehicle that has yet to be named, and that's going to be based on the Ford Escape. So it's going to be a smaller vehicle and maybe a little bit less committed to being a serious off-roader, but it's going to be more off-roady than the Escape. Anyway, there's some speculation now as to what that name might really be, because they're obviously not going to call it Baby Bronco.
Right.
So Ford has actually, Automotive News noticed this, but Ford's been to the Copyright Registration Office and registered a couple of interesting names, including Bronco Adventurer, Bronco Scout, Maverick.
Maverick?
Yeah, yeah.
Bronco Sport. Can they name the car Maverick? I mean, isn't there was already a Maverick, right?
Well, there was a Maverick. It was a compact car back in the 70s. It was a Ford.
Yeah.
And it was sort of Ford's equivalent to the Nova.
Right.
Now, I love the name because I'm a James Garner fan. I love the name just because it's a crazy 70s car
right,
name.
Right, right.
But I don't think it's going to be Maverick. Also, the thing about Maverick is that the Escape is called Maverick in other markets.
Oh, I see.
So it would really muddy the water if two different vehicles were called Maverick. So what I think is going to happen, and it's kind of bumming me out, is they're going to go with Bronco Sport. Yeah. There's a convention now in the auto industry where there's a big vehicle and then a smaller vehicle that has the same name with the sport suffix.
Oh, okay.
Like Range Rover Sport, and Outlander Sport.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure that's what they're going to do here.
Okay. All right. Who names these cars, by the way?
I don't know.
All right, Tom, hang on, okay?
I will.
Yeah, Tom Appel is with us from Consumer Guide Automotive. Follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. You can also check out consumerguide.com. More car news and calls. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200.
Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow than Mustang.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. There you go. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And the news is next, coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We're talking with Tom Appel, as we do every month, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And we're talking cars. And if you have a question, it's 312-981-7200. Talk and text. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about this this confusion, the Canadian confusion here. What's going on there?
This was something I had to write as sort of a catharsis, because I stumbled across this once several years ago, and it confused the heck out of me. But apparently, the Canadian auto market has always been just a little bit strange to Americans. They've just always done things a little bit different. Uh-huh. There have been Pontiacs that were actually rebadged Chevys for different reasons, and it all just seemed a little bit confusing. But one of the things I stumbled across one day, just looking around online, was something called Passport. And Passport was a General Motors dealership chain that appeared only in Canada and only for 3 years. And it was this really weird attempt to consolidate all these brands that General Motors had been buying in those days. And General Motors had been on a buying spree, having purchased both Isuzu and Saab and chunks of Daewoo. And in the United States, which is a bigger, more populous country, some of those brands could have their own dealerships. But that didn't work very well in Canada, where populations were spread out and you needed to kind of consolidate dealers just for efficiency's sake. So out of this confusion came Passport, which was a dealership chain that sold only a Isuzu, Saab, and one Daewoo model. And it was only around for 3 years.
Oh, man.
And the crazy part of it was that the Daewoo model was actually badged as a Passport. So for 3 years, there was this one car that was a Passport something. I always forget that. Oh, it was the Passport Optima. Which was a terrible little car. It was a version of the Pontiac Le Mans that was on sale in the U.S. at the time.
Oh, man.
But it's incredibly rare, but not in any way valuable.
Oh, boy. The Passport dealerships.
The Passport dealerships. And then those were replaced when Saturn came online. So then those were just junked, and then the Passport Optima was disappeared. And what Canada got was the Saturn Isuzu Saab dealership chain.
Isuzu?
Yes.
What?
Yeah, it's all very strange.
Wow. All right. I don't know how Canadians buy cars now. I'm just very confused by the whole thing.
I don't either, and I don't know how they did it then.
Okay. All right. Well, that story is available at Consumer Guide Automotive. on the Facebook, of course, I follow you, and I follow Consumer Guide Automotive on the Facebooks.
Thank you.
And you guys just at least showed up on my news feed about an hour ago. You reposted a story that you wrote a couple of years ago called "What Was the Red Bull Car?"
Yeah.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
That was such a weird thing. The Red Bull car, and people have seen these driving around, no doubt.
Yes.
Was a limited production run of versions of the Mini, and it was the Mini Cooper that had been chopped down to just a two-passenger vehicle and basically converted into pickup trucks. So there was the front half and then a flat bed, and then over the bed on two little stands was the actual can at an angle raised up over the hood. That was the giant Red Bull can that drove around. But these cars are actually kind of rare. They were custom built for Red Bull by a company called Custom CRS, which is no longer in business. The bulk of these are 2006 to 2008 Minis. Though it seems like I've seen later generations of them running around, and I don't know who builds those. But kind of the cool part is the pickup bed part actually hides coolers where they keep chilled cans of Red Bull for distribution at festivals and whatnot.
You know, I'm looking at because you have a picture of one of them without the Red Bull stuff all over it in the can, and they're weird looking cars.
They are weird looking, and apparently they're sought after by strange people.
Is that right?
Yeah. I guess I kind of get it.
Yeah.
I guess a Mini pickup is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a strange-looking car.
It is very weird.
Wow, okay. Well, you can check that out. You guys just reposted that up on Facebook. A couple of questions here, Tom.
All right.
Jesse says, hey, Tom, how is it that car companies are allowed to use extreme bright LED headlights on their vehicles? I'm concerned it could have a long-term effect on eyes.
We run into this question almost every time there's an advancement in headlights, and they always just seem extra bright. And I'm not really sure that they are brighter because there is federal caps on the lumen output of headlights. But when the halogen headlights first started showing up, and then when xenon gas headlights started showing up, and then now with the LEDs, it always seems like they're extra bright. But I think the difference is not that they're bright, but that it's a different wavelength, and they just stand out in traffic.
Yeah.
There's fewer of them, they look different, and they do seem glaring. But they're not actually brighter, because there is a regulation on the total light output. And in fact, I don't know if people have noticed this, but the LEDs will go off now. If your turn signal is on, the LED that's around that turn signal goes black so that you can see the turn signal.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a really interesting safety feature.
You know, the brightness of the lights is a concern of my father's. My father's 78, and you know, he still drives, and he drives great. But he's just, you know, the eyes are a little bit of an issue, you know, when you're driving at night, and some of these headlights are just so, like, if they're behind my dad and he looks in the rearview mirror, it drives him nuts, you know.
Yeah, I do know that effect, and I'm not getting any younger either, and yeah. I think that I'm starting to feel that same thing.
Yeah, it's just it's crazy, but yeah, especially if like it's a truck and it's higher up than us, and it's, you know, and it's behind the car, that's always an issue. That's always been an issue.
Yeah, and that's a problem too if you're in a car, because everyone's driving crossovers and SUVs now, are higher.
Yeah.
So that is a condition that's very much a problem.
Yeah. Well, okay. 779 area code sends in a text that says, any difference between Jeep and Honda CR-V or Ford Escape?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're looking at compact crossovers. That would be the Jeep Cherokee, the Ford Escape, and the, what was it, the CR-V?
Yeah.
In that category, I would recommend driving them all. The Cherokee is interesting that it's available with a 2-liter turbo, which is pretty punchy. The CR-V is just probably one of the best balanced cars. The Escape is brand new right now, and there's a new hybrid version that's pretty compelling. I have had very little experience with the new Escape. The base engine is now a 3-cylinder turbocharged engine, which should be very fuel efficient, but I would recommend driving them all, but paying special attention to the CR-V, which is a personal favorite.
Okay, all right. Real quickly, you guys wrote a first spin piece about the 2020 Ford Mustang Shelby GT500. How'd that go?
That's crazy. Yeah, our guy Rick Cotta on the road got to drive this over-the-top Shelby version of the Mustang. The GT350 is almost always the highest performance version of the Mustang, and it's back again now for 2020. This is now 760 horsepower from a supercharged 5.2-liter V8.
Jeez.
0 to 60 in something like 3 seconds. Just an incredibly fast car, and surprisingly affordable, given that it's ridiculously fast. It starts at about 73 grand. There is a very expensive carbon fiber performance package that takes it to about 90 grand.
Jeez.
You don't want that if you're going to drive it every day, because you're going to chip that carbon fiber and feel very bad about it.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy.
It is crazy. It's an insane car. It's kind of a collector piece. If you can hit the track with it, that's a great time. But I don't know about it as a commuter vehicle.
Hey, by the way, before we let you out of here, have you seen the trailer for Ford versus Ferrari?
I have, and this puts me in a weird spot, because I now must see this, because I don't know that much about that history.
Oh, okay.
But it looks fantastic.
It does look good, doesn't it?
It looks fantastic, and the story of the 66 24 Hours of Le Mans is awesome. And it looks like this is going to be pretty historically accurate, which is exciting.
That's great. Yeah, I'm excited to see it. You know, the guy who directed it directed Logan, which is like one of my favorite movies of the past couple of years.
And Carroll Shelby, whom this movie features heavily, was a crazy man.
Yeah.
Like, legitimately nuts. So that's fun.
Okay, very cool. Christian Bale, Matt Damon are the stars of this movie. It comes out right around Thanksgiving, so I'm looking forward to that. So we'll talk about it the next time we talk.
Yeah, I should see it by then, yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, have a great Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you. You too,
okay,
everybody.
All right, buddy, take care. Tom Appel, everybody, Consumer Guide Automotive. You can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And you can subscribe to the newsletter, by the way. We forgot to plug that. It's free. Go to consumerguide.com, sign up for the newsletter, and you'll get all the updates and all the stuff that they're going to be covering car-wise on consumerguide.com. So get that newsletter, and we'll talk to Tom again next month. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, and it's 2 for Tuesday. Yippee, 2 for Tuesday! It's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Okay, who requested that?
That's coming to us from Bob, a little UFO there.
That's right. There you go, UFO. Gotta love them. One of the best live albums of all time, Strangers in the Night. And I've said this before, I could have been at that show. But my parents wouldn't let me go because I only had a fever of 103. I could have made it. Oh, man. Anyway, could have been there. Amphitheater. So welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. So I don't know if you were, if you guys had the show on at the top at 1 o'clock when we got on the air. And I'm sure you've probably seen the footage already if you've watched the news or you've gone on the internet. But a black cat ran out onto the field during the Monday night football game, Cowboys Giants, last night. And it was hilarious. So, but this is not the first time that animals have interrupted sporting events. So we're going to talk about that. And but let's listen to the audio again of this. And if you've not seen it, really, you should go online because it's pretty hilarious. So let's hear it again.
Well, there's a cat. A black cat has taken the field. A black cat is running from the 20 to the near side, the 10. From the 39 in Dallas, here's a short throw down the middle, caught by Ingram. Caught at the 35, went to the 30. Now the cat running the other way. And so is Ingram at the 30 to the 25, to the 24-yard line of the Dallas Cowboys. It's a catch and run of 15. Now the cat is stopped at the 50. And the cat is in the CDW red zone. CDW, people who get it now, a policeman, a state trooper has come on the field. And the cat runs into the end zone. That is a touchdown.
And then the cat continues, though, because he runs into the, like, doesn't he, at one point he runs into the stands?
Yeah, he gets near the stands, and then he ends up, they kind of corral him to go down the, the walkway.
Yeah.
You know, they get him out of there.
Oh, man. That was so funny. You know, one of my favorites is, as I mentioned before, I like it when the seagulls just show up at Wrigley. It usually happens, you know, it's usually, like, late in the summer, and it's usually around near dusk. Is when they show up, like 4:30 or so. You know, if you're playing a later game, you get a. I mean, sometimes there are a ton of seagulls out there, and it's really distracting. And I also love the fact that when they do cover the games on television, you can't ignore the seagulls, so they get close ups. You know, they get coverage from the thing, and the guys in the outfield are like, what the hell am I? What is going on? But it's really funny. Another one of my favorite things, and this is an old clip here from WGN. It's a Spike. It's from Spike Odell. So when we were over at the across the river at the Trib building, you know, we in the studio right now in many of the studios there are flat screens. I've got a couple of TVs that are on. Like one is on channel 9, one is on channel 26. And then there's another flat screen. That I have the security cameras on, so I can see Vic in the newsroom, I can see who's in the sports department, who's in the traffic department, and then there's an outdoor camera that is on the floor of the building here outside that's aimed at the bridge across the street, so you can see what's happening outside. One time Spike Odell was on the air and we had very similar security thing. There was a camera on the outside of the roof of the Tribune building and it aimed across the street at the Wrigley building. So in it, you could see like Michigan Avenue and the Wrigley building, and it was on the roof of the Trib building, and it was a security camera and it was part of the screens that we were on. So I'll never forget this because I heard it live and then it became like a promo. This is like sort of a classic Spike Odell moment where they did a promo for it. And what happened was a spider had kind of spun a web on the lens of the camera and was hanging in front of the lens of the camera. And it appeared, and Spike started describing it, they played crazy music. Spike started describing it like, there's a giant tarantula on the Wrigley building. You know what I mean? Because it looked like there was a giant spider on the Wrigley building, climbing up the Wrigley building. And they kept, because it was doing it like most of the morning, like it would, you know, spiders, sometimes they dangle down on their web and then they pull themselves back up. They dangle down again. And they kept doing it. And Spike just kept updating it because he was looking at the screen. And they got out very dramatic music. And it was him describing, you know, a giant spider on the Wrigley building, which is really funny because there's actually a movie where a giant grasshopper destroys the Wrigley building. In a 1950s movie, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but there's a giant grasshopper that attacks the Wrigley building.
Really?
In an old sci-fi movie from the 50s, yeah. But yeah, I remember listening to that live, and it was so funny. Is that it?
Well, it's a little bit of music, a little bit of monster music.
Oh. Yeah. There it is. Yeah, that's what they were playing, stuff like this. And Spike's going, oh my God, the giant spider is now climbing, you know, the roof of the Wrigley building. And it was just... And there's also, like, I love it when there's, like, a, you know, like, there's a, maybe there's a traffic cam or something on the street, and a bird goes up, like, right to the front. It just stands right in front of the lens. And you get this giant bird face in the, you know, in the intersection. Bird doesn't know there's a camera there. He's maybe pecking on it. Oh, it's funny. It's so funny. All right. We're talking about animals interrupting sporting events, and a good one happened last night. And that was in Jersey, right? Because they were, it was the Giants. They were, yeah. They, okay, yeah, so it was in Jersey. So there's a, there was a New Jersey cat running around.
Typical Jersey cat.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man. All right, here is taxi driver Bob. Hey, Bob.
Hey, I was wondering if you ever ended up, I know you had two cats and you got married, and I think you went into it how the ex took the two cats and you never got the cats.
Well, no, that's not exactly what happened. I had two cats, and then when I moved in with my girlfriend who became my wife, she already had a cat. She had a big, giant cat who would have killed my cats, would have killed them. And so I gave my cats to a new home, and I kept, you know, and I kept an eye on them through friends who had my cats. But yeah, I had to give up my two cats because this cat that my ex-wife had, this thing was a monster. It was like 40 pounds. It would have killed my cats. Very territorial.
So do you have a cat now?
I do not.
Are you planning to get one?
Well, I was thinking about it, you know, but I'm not home, you know, as much as I should be to take. Well, I mean, cats are very independent anyway, so I would never have a dog. There's no way that it would be fair to the dog because I wouldn't be able to take care of it the way it should be taken care of. But
you know, the Bears at one time had a cat on the field every time they played. Big Cat Williams.
Oh, there you go. Wait, hold on. All right, Bob. Thanks, buddy.
You have a good one.
Right, yeah, sometimes I think about getting a cat.
Oh, trust me, I've been thinking about it all the time.
Because I love them. I love
They're
cats.
They're great animals.
I'm a cat guy. I mean, I like dogs, but I've always been a cat guy. And I know that's, you know, most people are like dog people. I think the majority of people would prefer dogs over cats. That's what I think.
Yeah.
But I'm a cat person.
There's some mean cats out there, though.
Oh, yeah. Listen, one of the reasons why I like cats is because they don't put up with any crap. You know what I mean? Like, just feed me and shut up.
My dad used to hate cats because when he was a kid, his auntie would keep her cat in her purse. Like, she would take her cat places in her purse, but she'd close the purse.
Was it a tiny cat?
It was relatively small. It started getting big, though. And one day he was over at his auntie's for tea, and she says, "Oh, Kenny, let go get the cat. Go get the cat out of my purse." So goes over and he opens up the purse and it jumps out and literally latched itself onto his face. And he said, "I'll be damned if there's ever a cat in this house ever again."
Yeah, yeah. That's all it takes is one time, man. But yeah. So you know the cat that I'm talking about that when I moved in. His name was Mr. Ruffle, and I'm not kidding. He was a giant cat. I mean, he weighed 40 pounds, but he was huge. I mean, a huge cat. And I started calling him Coconut Head because he had a head the size of a coconut. And then we just started calling him Nut, and so that was his name. But he was a huge cat, and he hated me when I first started dating her. Hated me, attacked me at one point. But then we got to know each other and, you know, and eventually, because I worked nights and my ex worked days and we used to sleep. The cat and I would sleep during the day and we became close buddies. And the cat passed away a couple of years ago. Yeah. But
did he still have his claws?
Did he still have his claws?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, some people declaw their cats.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
No.
I don't like that, but some people do.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, you know, he had his claws. Oh, and he dug them into me a bunch of times. So, yeah. So I was attacked by that cat. I was attacked by the Nut a bunch of times, but we ended up getting along. He was a great cat. He was a great cat. Loudest purr I've ever heard in my life. Because he was 900 pounds. It was seriously the loudest purr I've ever heard.
Like a lawnmower.
I'm not kidding. It was like brrr, brrr, like jeez. But he was a cool cat. He was cool. Would not be able to run out on the field like that. Not a fast cat.
No.
But and he was getting older too, and he weighed a lot, and so we'd have to pick him up and put him on the bed because he got to the point where like he couldn't jump up on the bed. or jump up on the couch or something. Oh. So we would have to like pick him up because he was older and fat.
Poor guy.
Man, did he like to eat? Obviously, he was a bit. He could put it away. So he was a good cat. It was fun. So the two cats that I had to give up were called Jackass and Bangs. Bangs after Lester Bangs. And Jackass after my ex and I, this is another girl that I lived with. We got these cats together. After my ex and I witnessed his behavior the first night we had him. And we're like, this cat is a jackass. And they were cool cats. They were very, very cool cats. I grew up with, I've told you this before. I grew up with a cat, black cat, Angora long fur, named Velvet. Lived to be 23. Yeah. He died when I moved out. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it. But, you know, he definitely liked me. That he was my cat. There was no question about it. He was my cat. So, you know, my parents have two cats, too, and they're black. Both of them are black. And they adore my mom. They're just ridiculous, especially Max. It's Max and Boo are the cat's names. And Max just goes nuts, you know, my mom. My mom sits on it. She's got her chair, and there's a footstool. And the cat will come up on the footstool and just like hit her with his paw and just cry. And just meow, meow, meow.
Until she gives him attention.
Yeah.
Ah. So that's cute.
Cool cats. All right. Why don't we take a quick break? When we come back, we have more animals interrupting sporting events. Here's what it says. People, this is from the Bleacher Report, everybody. People come out by the thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, to watch a sporting event live. Of course, humans aren't the only ones attracted to stadiums, golf courses, and tennis courts. Most outdoor sports require a fairly large open playing space, which are known to attract animals. Plus, where there are humans, there is food, and where there is food, there is usually animals. Whatever the reasons, maybe they're looking for an easy meal, or maybe they just really like attention, animals interrupting sporting events has been a pretty common occurrence. Thanks to the magic of the digital age, most of these troublemakers are caught on camera and end up on the internet where you can find fame. So why don't we take a look at some of these animals that are interrupting sporting events, and we'll describe those to you. And we've got audio of some interrupting animals that we'll get to. Band rules. I love UFO, man. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. And we're about to have some fun listening to some audio of animals interrupting sporting events. Last night, a black cat got out on the field during the Monday night football game and made a spectacle of himself. And we've had many other animals interrupting sporting events, and that's what we're going to jump into here. Jerry in Kansas City, in Kansas, says, cats are awesome. I have one laying on top of me right now. Two of the other three are in the other room. Andre, my cat, is outside. So that's five cats? Wow. Brian says, how about a Naked Gun? During the baseball blooper montage, a lion attacks a player who's sliding into second base. I love that Naked Gun for the last 40 minutes is a baseball movie. I just think that... Yeah, and that that whole blooper montage is hilarious. I mean, Naked Gun is a hilarious movie anyway. And then, of course, Brian brings up the how about the Randy Johnson bird explosion incident. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of legendary. For people who might not know, Randy Johnson was a guy who could throw hard. Big, tall, big dude who was a pitcher who could throw hard. Had a killer fastball. And I can't remember what team they were playing, but he's on the mound. It's the middle of the day. And he gets into his stretch and then the windup, and he guns a fastball. A bird happened to fly by just as he was throwing the ball, and it explodes. Like, the ball hits the bird, and the bird explodes. And I'm not exaggerating. For those of you who've seen the footage, you know that it's not an exaggeration. Randy Johnson exploded that bird with his fastball. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I go, what? How can that happen? But yeah, that's a pretty classic thing. Terrifying, actually. So, all right. Now, Tom, you've seen Randy Johnson explode the bird.
Yeah, it's it's magic.
It's crazy.
What? How many things had to perfectly line up
for
that to happen?
What are the odds? Seriously, what are the odds of that bird flying by exactly at that moment when he guns a fastball, and then, boom, the bird just explodes?
I mean, I feel bad for the bird,
yeah,
but, you
know,
at least it went out in a blaze of glory.
Man.
Immortalized.
Man. Okay, here's some more examples of animals interrupting sporting events. Golfer Rory McIlroy may have won the 2014 British Open, but this dapper fellow dog stole the attention of ESPN's Peter Ailitz, joined Scott Van Pelt when the stocky pup emerged from the seaside brush. Clearly satisfied with the day's events thus far, they made the timely remark, "Where the hell have you been?" So a dog came out during the British Open. Where did it come from?
That's always my question with a lot of the kind of house pets. Like, where did the dog come from? Where did the cat come from?
Yeah.
Squirrel, I get.
Right.
Bird, I get.
Yeah.
Where'd the dog come from?
How about this? A bird makes a cameo at the British Open and chooses not to fly. We've all been there, that moment when you realize that you've just walked into the wrong class or the middle of a heated argument. Once the awkwardness sinks in, you know that the only place you want to be in the world is not here. Well, at the 2014 British Open, wait a minute, the same guy? It's the same British Open as the dog. Rory McIlroy, his putt was delayed by a bird that experienced just such an episode, and like us humans, the fleeting discombobulation made it forget about how to do something that's second nature. So, So the bird just stood there. This is the same guy. The same guy, the same British Open. He had dogs and birds out on the course with him.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. We have a little, why don't we play a little audio here? We have now to explain what this is. There's a squirrel that went out it was a Kent State?
Yeah, so it was a Kent State Louisville game, and this is kind of legendary. I know that I originally played it back when it happened. This is only from a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And this squirrel goes out, and the entire crowd goes insane. And, I mean, you just can hear it in the announcer's voice. This is amazing.
Open field runner. Yeah. Hey, look at him go. The 20. Wes, he might do it. Wes, he's going to do it. Oh, my goodness, buddy, do it. Do it.
He's my favorite squirrel?
Yeah.
My favorite squirrel.
Oh, man, that's funny. How about this one? We have a squirrel bounds around a ballpark. The eastern gray squirrel is no stranger to captive sporting event audiences, and only one thing is certain: when a squirrel finds itself cornered in an immaculately kept turf in a Major League Baseball park, expect the uncertain. Despite these cold, dead eyes, squirrel panic is easily observed by the cautious prancing that quickly devolves into frantic galloping. At this Philadelphia Phillies-Colorado Rockies game in April, the game may go on, but this squirrel, who's clearly on the verge of an old-fashioned freakout, is just stealing the show. Squirrels are nuts anyway.
No pun intended?
Yeah, no pun intended. No, they're crazy. And I'll tell you what, when my ex-wife and I we're living together, we had a little garden outside on our back porch. The squirrels ate everything. Ate everything. All the tomatoes, everything. The only thing they wouldn't eat was basil.
Like,
so we had tons of basil. We had a lot of beautiful, fresh basil. But anything else we tried to grow, these idiots would be up there. And we would see them because it was right on the back porch outside our kitchen window. And they would just come right there, brazenly just walk up to the window and go, "How you doing? I'm eating a tomato. I'm a squirrel and I'm eating a tomato." We were on the third floor, so we would climb up the tree. We had a tree right overlooking our back porch. So they'd climb up the tree, they would eat the tomatoes, and just stand there on the back porch, daring us to do anything. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do? I'm a squirrel. I'll either bite you or I'll jump onto this tree and leave, and then I'll come back in the middle of the night and I'll eat some more tomatoes. So shut up. All right. Let's take a break for some news. And then we'll come back. We've got more crazy animals interrupting sporting events. We got some audio and more stuff like that. And more here. 312-981-7200 for Talk and Text on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Skyline studio here till 5, as I am every weekday morning from 1 to 5. I'm your overnight dude. Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday.
Get your requests in. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Who requested the Blondie?
It's coming to us from Steve.
All right. There you go. So welcome back, everybody. We're having some fun here. We're going to play more audio of animals interrupting sporting events. Last night, a black cat stole the show at Monday Night Football in New Jersey when it ran out onto the field. And so there have been other incidents like that, and we're talking about those. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. How about this? 630 area code. One was during the Daytona 500 early 90s. Dale Earnhardt was leading the race, and a seagull flew right in front of the car and hit his car. The video in slow motion is the best, except for the bird. Yeah, I bet. Hey, Tom, you remember when Fabio was riding the roller coaster and a seagull smashed into his face?
Wait, what? When did that happen?
Whoa. You don't know this?
No.
Okay, you can just Google Fabio roller coaster bird. It smashed into his face while he was on a roller coaster. Fabio, you know, hair, Fabio.
Yeah,
I know. I can't believe it's not butter, Fabio. Anyway, he was in the front car of a roller coaster, and he was on the roller coaster, and a bird flew and smashed him in the face, and he was bleeding, like busted his nose. He had blood all over his face when they were rolling into the station after the ride. You don't remember this? It was a while ago.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Did you see it?
Covered in blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Fabio got smashed in the face by a bird while he was on a roller coaster.
Yeah, I guess it was a goose or something.
I don't know. It did a lot of damage, though. He was bleeding all over the place. I mean, he was fine. You know, he said he was fine and everything, but it looked terrible. Like, there was blood all over his face. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he was on the roller coaster and blood was just flying all over his face because you were outside on a roller coaster going, like, 70 miles an hour or whatever. But, yeah, that happened. Bird smashed Fabio's face. 630 area code sends in a text. By the way, you can text or call us, 312-981-7200. Hey, Nick, I went to a golf outing in Orlando, and on the 7th green, there was an alligator or a crocodile, and not good with reptiles. All I know is this big bad boy would not move for a good 10 minutes, so you couldn't play. Well, you know what happened to Carl Weathers on a golf course with an alligator. We've all seen Happy Gilmore. Oh, man.
Just tap it in.
All right. How about this? Alaska seems like the kind of place where very large animals just tip their hat to passersby on the way to a remote post office when passersby aren't trying to shoot them. Just to be clear, the people are going to the post office in that scenario, not the animals. So when a big old black bear went on a leisurely trek around an American Legion baseball game in Juneau, Alaska in June of 2014, rather than the players and their fans dispersing in chaotic panic, they gazed without urgency. The bear responded in kind with his or her own lack of urgency before wandering off to search trash cans. So that's the thing. You get used to it. You're from Alaska and like, oh, there's a bear. All right. Okay. Now, what is this? We were talking about an alligator already, because alligators have been known to end up on golf courses. This is a thing. But this was a PGA tour in Zurich?
Yeah, there was a PGA tournament in Zurich.
Yeah.
And a three-legged alligator made its way onto the course.
A three-legged alligator?
Yep.
So an alligator missing one leg.
Missing one leg, just got a little stump there.
Uh-huh.
And it just kind of wandered onto the course.
Okay.
And was literally right behind golfers,
okay.
Literally right behind them. So we got a little bit of the announcers here, and of course they keep their hushed tones because they are still golf announcers.
It's still golf. So okay.
Dun, dun, dun. This guy's, I suppose, happy.
He's in prancing mode. Oh look, he's right behind the
it's like that James Bond movie, wasn't it?
That's a real hazard right there.
They play it far. This is all about the slow play rule now. This is to get the guys to play a little bit faster. Just put an alligator behind them.
He's got another responsibility there. Warn his player if there's danger. Wow.
Yeah, remote control alligators. They are not real, folks.
That's hilarious. I like the dramatic music the guys were doing. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. You remember the movie Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yes, barely.
There's a fantastic scene in that. That's actually a pretty entertaining movie. There's a fantastic scene in that movie that takes place in, like, a room that's filled with aquariums filled with alligators. So essentially, it's a shootout. So they just start shooting the glass, and the alligators come out and just start killing people. It's a fantastic scene. It's really hilarious because they just go, oh, let's just get the alligators out here and they'll
boom.
Yeah.
I think gator movies, underrated.
Well, we had a good one this year.
Very good one. It said Quentin Tarantino apparently said that it might be his favorite film of the year.
Crawl?
Yeah.
I enjoyed the hell out of it.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Alexander Aja. High tension, man. So, we got another... Oh, wait, we got this one here, right here. The three-legged alligator is mentioned in this in the article that I have in front of me. They named him Stumpy. His name was Stumpy. Stumpy the alligator. All right, so the next bit of audio we're going to play, I want to talk a little bit about it. It's a praying mantis in the Marlins dugout. So there is this fantastic audio when we used to broadcast the Cubs games here on WGN. And we had Pat Hughes and Ron Santo in the booth. I used to do this thing called the Pat and Ron Show Highlight Reel, where, like our Friday segments, like Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies, it would require the listeners to listen to the games. And when they hear something really funny, again, jot down the day, the time, who said it, just like you guys do when you listen for a mention of me for Nick D Show Spies, or a mention of something that could be construed as dirty. For Straight Out of Context, you jot down the day, the time, who said it, and send it to nickdshow@gmail.com. So we used to do the same thing for the Pat and Ron Show highlight reel. And then we would, every Sunday night, we would play back those week's highlights. Because Pat and Ron were hilarious in the booth. Hilarious. And even if the Cubs were bad, it was great to listen to those games because they were great. So one night, during a night game, a giant bug got into the booth. And they both started freaking out. And I believe Matt Bolts was the engineer at that time, and he was there. They were trying to kill it with a program. They were like, but it was like this massive. I don't remember what kind of insect it was, but it was this big insect that completely freaked both Pat and Ron out. I think Ron actually just got up and walked away. Right, Ron just it's like I'm not gonna. There's no way I'm gonna sit here. But it was really, really funny audio of a giant insect attacking Pat and Ron. And then, of course, the classic one doesn't involve animals, though. They were in New York at Shea Stadium, and Ron hated Shea Stadium. He hated the Mets ever since 1969. Of course, we can talk about the black cat that came out on the field at Wrigley to curse the Cubs in 1969. But he hated the Mets. He made no bones about it. You know, when Ron didn't like something, you knew about it. And if he liked something like the show Jag, you knew about it. So they're in the booth at Shea Stadium, and this is classic. It was cold. It was like an April, like an early April game, and it was really cold. So they had a portable heater in the booth with them, and it set Ron's toupee on fire. His head was on fire at one point because it was just like it had those coils. You know those heaters that have those glowing coils. It got on it for some, I don't know how. I guess it was hanging above their heads. The heater, and it set his toupee on fire. And there's the audio of that is fantastic, but that doesn't have anything to do with an animal. But a giant insect did terrorize them one night. So, how about this? A moose. Unfortunately, there's no video photographic evidence of this one. But it sounds wild enough, a wild enough scene to be worth mentioning. According to the Lawrence Journal World, two curious moose interrupted a Little League baseball game back in 2001. The animals were spotted roaming near the field, and the game had to be stopped after the fourth inning because they were attempting to make their way onto the field. Although it doesn't seem like they were aggressive, separating kids from wild animals is always a good idea. Yeah.
Moose are scary.
Could you imagine that? Two moose just walking out onto a Little League field?
They just want to watch the game.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, moose are scary. They are. All right, so we were just talking about the giant insect that terrorized Pat and Ron in the booth a bunch of years ago during a Cub game. But a praying mantis freaked out people. Is this in Florida?
Yeah, this is in Florida. They got a praying mantis got into the dugout with hilarious results. Okay. I think friends were made lifelong.
This is the Marlins dugout that this praying mantis just showed up in. Okay.
Clay Hensley is being attacked by a praying mantis. Now it looks like Hensley and the praying mantis have made up, and now they're buddies. There were a few players that tried to brush him off, and Hensley fought those players off as if to save the praying mantis. You know, it appears, Tommy, that the praying mantis is watching the game because his eyes have been trained on home plate.
Getting a tweet saying we should name the praying mantis Mickey Mantis.
So this was relatively recently because they were tweeting about it. So
yeah, it's back in 2011.
Oh, man, that's funny. Mickey Mantis.
How appropriate.
Oh. All right, how about this? Pigeons became enough of a problem at Wimbledon that groundskeepers decided to take pretty serious measures to prevent them from menacing players during one of the tennis's preeminent events. A falconer with a hawk named Rufus are employed to keep order. What? There's a falconer at Wimbledon all the time?
Mm-hmm.
With a hawk named Rufus that is employed to keep order on the grass courts. Although Rufus does his best, it seems the pigeon problem isn't entirely solved. Last month at Wimbledon, a pigeon actually dive-bombed Roberto Bautista Agut mid-serve during a match against Andy Murray. It was among many things that didn't go well for Agut that day. So he got dive-bombed by a pigeon. I can't believe that they actually hire a falconer.
Well, they have to. It's the only way that they found that they can at least keep the pigeons away.
Is it Will Forte? Is he the? What was this falcon's name?
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. I can't remember. The falconer. He had I can't remember the falcon's name. It was funny every time. The best one was when everybody became a falconer. It was when Kevin Spacey was the host. And there were, like, at the end of the episode, or at the end of the sketch, there were, like, 15 falconers, all dressed up like Will Forte.
Yeah. I know he was... Ken Mortimer, the falconer.
Right.
And his falcon named Donald.
Donald, that's right. Donald. Oh, Donald! Oh, Donald! all right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and wrap this up. We got a few more pieces of audio of animals interrupting sporting events for their own entertainment. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here on WGN. Oh, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live on the in the Skyline studio here and WGN. I just, by the way, I was messing around on my Facebook page, and I changed my picture on my Facebook page because I found a picture of a close up of the cat running down the football field. So that's my picture on Facebook.
It's a big cat.
He is. Big black cat. So that's my Facebook picture now, is the infamous cat from last night's Monday night game. So, okay. Hey, by the way, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. It's 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. 312-981-7200. Okay. A very cranky cat takes issue with an attempted ejection. An adventurous cat invaded the field at a Myrtle Beach Pelicans game in July of 2010, and she was not very receptive to efforts aimed at removing her. Initially, it seemed like the cat may be friendly, but right around the 35-second mark in the clip, it does that insane back arch thing that cats do when they're really mad. Explains why the player immediately backs off any attempts to wrangle it. Eventually, the cat is nabbed by a very brave groundskeeper who exits through the gate in the outfield. Yeah, you don't want to mess with a cat when it's like that. It starts hissing and arching the back. You just best stand back.
Move on.
Yeah. All right, we have a parakeet terrorizing the New York Mets. How does this happen?
They're not entirely sure, but essentially a very bright kind of neon green parakeet appeared in the net behind home plate.
Okay.
To catch the balls. And it seemed to match Cespedes as he was wearing like an arm warmer.
Uh-huh.
It was the exact same color as the parakeet, so it became the rally parakeet.
Okay. Was it there for most of the... I mean, was it just there?
Yeah, it just showed up. I guess it got loose, and it proved to be pretty helpful for the Mets, as you'll hear a little bit here.
Right. Parakeet on the backstop screen.
Wow.
Where do you belong, little parakeet?
He got out.
Do you have anything to say?
Should have left
a microphone?
Should have left the hood over. He should have been asleep. He got out.
Coincidence that the parakeet matches Cespedes' sleeve? Well, the Mets have only utilized the rally parakeet once tonight when they scored twice in the fourth. Cespedes drives one. Deep right center field. Headed back toward the wall. It's out of here! Yoenis Cespedes with his first home run as a New York Met. The rally parakeet lives. 3-0 New York.
So they attribute the home run to the parakeet.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
The rally parakeet, baby.
Rally parakeet. All right. How about this? Few animals get away with but much get celebrated for it. Like our canine companions, dogs are designed to facilitate mayhem and get lovin's in return. A few dogs embody the idea more exquisitely than the softball glove snatching vagabond. In 2014, this lovable mutt ran out onto the field during a softball game between West Oregon and Simon Fraser, BC, and tried to make off with some mitts before getting ejected. So he wanted to steal all the mitts.
Silly boy.
Bees terrorize baseball stadiums. This is a real thing. This has happened a lot. Of all the potential animals to interrupt a sporting event, a swarm of bees is the least awe-inducing. And considering people with serious allergies, they are probably the most dangerous. For some reason, bees seem particularly attracted to baseball games. It must be all the popcorn and Cracker Jacks. Although they are regular visitors to some stadiums, such as Wrigley Field in Chicago, they've made very dramatic scenes at least two games last year. In September of 2013, bees caused a 23-minute delay at a Los Angeles Angels-Seattle Mariners game in Anaheim. And this past April, a massive swarm of bees interrupted a spring training game between Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. Don't the bees know they can't interrupt the Red Sox-Yankees game?
Mm-hmm.
Don't they understand the rivalry there?
Well, and I've definitely seen video of Jason Hayward literally jumping up into get away from the bees.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and then finally we have another squirrel. They seem very popular because they're squirrely. What's going on here?
So with this one, a squirrel gets onto Progressive Field where the Indians play.
Right.
And it's just a squirrel making the rounds on the bases, really.
Just running around.
Yeah, running around. And they've got the play-by-play has a few choice words for
okay.
the squirrel.
There's a squirrel out on the infield. And unfortunately for the Indians, that squirrel represents probably as much activity as the Indians have had on the base pass today. That little guy now is coming down to the third baseline. He's heading for home. Oh, he's got a quick first step. He's going to go behind the umpire. Even he says, I don't like you. Well, now it's down by the grandstand down the left field line. And this is where you got to be careful. That thing comes up. It did. It jumped into the seats. Free T-shirt day here today. And One lucky fan's going to be able to take home Bucky the Squirrel.
That's pretty. That's got to be scary, though, if you're sitting there and suddenly a squirrel just jumps up into the stands.
Yeah, I've dealt with squirrels. They're not always nice.
Oh, no. No. All right. When a dog runs out onto the field during a game, oftentimes athletes seem more interested in petting it than removing it. The same can't be said about foxes, which may look adorable like dogs, but they behave more like spooked cats and are known for carrying rabies. In September 2013, a fox somehow made its way to the sidelines during a football game between TCU and Texas Tech. Not a single player on the sideline makes a move in the direction of the fox, preferring to ignore it and hope it just goes away. Oh, man. And then we've got the most adorable streakers ever. During a 2013 match between Turkey's Galatasaray and Germany's VFR, two pantsless ne'er-do-wells brought the action to a sudden halt when they crashed the pitch to throw a very special party, a Labrador puppy party. There's no party like a Labrador puppy party, because a Labrador puppy party is mandatory, whether dancing around surly footballers with a towel in mouth or being carried off the pitch like overgrown babies. And then finally, Australia's kangaroo course. Oh, there's a shock. They have an issue with kangaroos in Australia? What's it take to make an LPGA tournament, or any golf tournament for that matter, exciting and worth watching? How about a massive marsupial invasion on the fairway, holding everything up while they just screw around? That's what happened at the Australian Open in February of 2013. Well over a dozen kangaroos randomly hopped onto the course, interrupting the players on the ninth hole. A dozen of them? The kangaroos caused a short delay, but they were much friendlier than the Black Widow Spider, which invaded the tournament and bit a golfer earlier in that week. I'm telling you, Australia is just, everything is going to kill you in Australia. Every creature in Australia will kill you. That's all there is to it. So, I can't believe a dozen kangaroos out on the golf course.
That's a ton. That's a lot.
That's crazy.
They're big.
Yeah.
Big creatures.
And they will kill you like every other creature in Australia, the death capital of the world. Oh, man. All right. Well, there you go. The black cat got out on the field last night, and that's not the first time it's happened. And obviously, we just discussed some of the more memorable ones. Okay. We are going to talk about the most expensive movie collectibles, because some of them are very, very ridiculous. So we'll do that coming up right after we take a break for the news, which is next. I know you don't lose it, this new Snoop. Come on, baby boy, you got to get into it. Don't fool with the player with the cool wit. Yeah, yeah, you know I'm always on that cool. Yeah. Do it how you do it. Have a blast. Okay. Two for Tuesday, man. Yeah, man, do it. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. One artist, two songs. Who requested the Snoop Dogg?
It's coming to us from Mike in Old Irving Park.
Okay, Mike in Old Irving Park. Are these songs suitable to play on the radio?
Yes, I checked.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay, because I know sometimes those rap guys, they like to swear.
They might say damn or hell or something like that.
Oh, boy. Did you ever watch The Joker's Wild with Snoop?
No.
He was the host of The Joker's Wild. The game show.
Like TBS or something?
Yeah, TNT or TBS, one of those. So, hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200. And, all right. Now, Tom, do you have any movie collectibles? I know that you're a big movie fan. I know you got some posters and all that kind of stuff, and I know you've got T-shirts and all kinds of cool stuff, but do you have any, like, collectibles?
Yes, I do have a replica of Sting from The Lord of the Rings, so Frodo's sword and also Bilbo's sword. So that's the one that he gives him that lights up blue, and it is signed by Elijah Wood.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Where'd you get that?
My dad bought it from a a place that makes replicas, and they specifically do a lot of the stuff like the Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, like they'll do the replica wands and everything like that. And then my dad was overseas, and he happened to be staying in the same hotel as Elijah Wood. And he had the sword with him? Yeah, he bought the replica overseas. Because I think the company is called like Noble Collections or something like that. And they would have it in the plane, like, you know, almost like what's Sky Mall?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, oh, okay. Thing. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but he had it delivered to where he was overseas. And he just happened to receive it. And there was Elijah Wood. He was at the hotel.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was wild.
I told you I have a samurai sword from because Michael Madsen was drunk.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be on my show, and he was drunk. And then he canceled one time, and then when he got on the show, he was drunk, dropped the F-bomb a few times. And so by way of apology, his agent sent me a samurai sword signed by him and David Carradine. Like an actual real samurai sword.
I'm so filled with jealous rage. I'm like wearing my Kill Bill Volume 1 shirt right now.
Right.
It's not even fair. That's
and it
so
does
cool.
have a little tag attached to the handle. It does have a little tag that says Kill Bill.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I didn't expect it, too. It showed up at the Tribune. It showed up at our offices. they sent it to us because, you know, the agent, that's a good agent, I will say.
Very nice agent.
It's a good agent. You know what I mean? You don't want to... You know, you don't want to make people angry or have a bad reputation. So I didn't expect this. They didn't, you know, there was a little note inside that said, "Hey, by way of apology for Michael Madsen's, you know, behavior, take this." And I was like, "There's a big long box right by my teeny little mailbox that I had over at the in the mailroom of the Trib,"
mm-hmm.
and it was just a huge thing. And I opened it up and. It's a
that's
real,
so
like a real samurai sword.
That's so wild. I'm surprised that they didn't like stop it or something. Like,
you know what? I think it was probably, you know, my guess is it was like probably UPS. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But this was when we were in the downstairs in the Trib building, but before we went up, you know, to the seventh floor.
Right,
this is when
right.
everything was downstairs, all the offices and everything were downstairs. And the mailboxes were right by the back door. Like if you came in through the back door, had you ever worked there when we were down on the.
No, because I started in 2016.
Oh, right. Because we moved upstairs. We moved upstairs in 20... When did we move upstairs? What year was the... 2000, I think we went upstairs 2010. Or 2000... Yeah, 2010, I think, is when we went up to the seventh floor. So... Because I remember we were up there the day of the... So I remember I don't know if it was relatively new, but I remember we were upstairs on the seventh floor when that insane storm came through that closed down Lollapalooza. I mean, like that really, the craziest yeah. one. I know Lollapalooza has been evacuated like 16 times,
yeah.
but this was like the risk 2011.
It might have been 2012 because I was at the one in 2012 that got evacuated.
2012. It was whenever.
Yeah, summer of 2012.
It was whenever. My ex-producer, Dan Chagrou, got married because it happened on the day they got married. Because I remember I was at work and I couldn't go to the wedding and because I needed to. At that time I was getting paid by the hour, so I needed as much airtime as possible. So, and, you know, I thought it was the end of the world. But we were upstairs at that time. I just remember that. So. Yeah, I mean, I have movie stuff. I've, you know, over the years because of this job, you know, things have been sent to me, like promo things have been sent to me over the years. Our friend Deanna.
Oh yeah, the frog.
I have an actual frog from Magnolia that was used in the movie. It's got a certificate of authenticity. Deanna, she's just so sweet. And it's big. It's a big, kind of a slimy rubber frog that was used, an actual prop that was used in Magnolia when the frog's raining from the sky. And it's on the desk in the office. I think people walk past because it's right. You can see it right through the window.
Oh yeah,
and it's big, and it's under like a like a plastic casing, like it's on display. And so I I don't even know what people think when they walk past.
Hell, it throws me off, and I know what it is. I know it's a prop. I know what it's from, and I'm like, God.
I mean, it looks real. It looks real and slimy and big. It's a big, fat frog. Frogs are my favorite animal, by the way.
That's your favorite animal?
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you could be an animal, would you be a frog?
I don't want to be a frog, but no. I just think frogs are awesome. I always have, and that's one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons why Magnolia might be one of my favorite movies. Well, it is my favorite movie ever, but I didn't expect frogs to come flying out of the sky, and they are my I love frogs. I think they're awesome.
Terrified of them.
Are you really?
Yeah, there's something about their, I used to always be kind of scared of them growing
you ever
up.
You ever see the movie Frogs?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Ray Milland? Sam Elliott, mustacheless?
That's even scarier.
That's terrifying. Sam Elliott sans mustache. That is a terrible movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah, no.
The frogs are in charge of nature,
mm-hmm.
and they encourage all the other animals to fight back and kill the humans. So it's just a bunch of animals, and then just the frogs are like telecommunicating with them.
Well, that, and I grew up near a lot of water. You know, there were a lot of ponds and creeks near where I live. So playing with other kids, they'd pick up frogs and like throw them at me and stuff like that. And that really, they just hop on you. I don't like it. There's just something about them.
Well, no wonder you're uneasy about the Magnolia prop.
Yeah. Now every time I walk in, I look at my mortal enemy, the bullfrog.
I love frogs. So anyway, but I have that. And I'm going to thank Deanna for that. And I've got a few other things. But get this now. One of the reasons why we're going to be talking about this, we're going to be talking about the most expensive movie collectibles of all time. And if you guys have any collectibles and you want to jump in here, maybe from movies or anything else that you collect, but we're going to be talking about really, really expensive movie collectibles. 312-981-7200. So get this. Out of Beverly Hills, California, two collectors said, "You're the one that I want," to Olivia Newton-John's iconic grease leather jacket and skin-tight pants at an auction Saturday in Beverly Hills. Julian's Auctions said the combined ensemble, which Newton-John's character Sandy wears in the closing number of the 1978 film, fetched, get this, $405,700. Almost $406,000 for the jacket and the pants. The leather jacket sold for $243,200, and the pants, which Newton famously had to be sewn into, went for $162,500. Other Grease memorabilia included a pink ladies jacket that went for $50,000, and a poster signed by Newton-John, John Travolta, and director Randall Cleaser, and producer and songwriter John Farrar, which sold for $64,000. $64,000 for an autographed poster? Really?
Imagine having that kind of like blow off money. Just like, yeah, I'm going to drop
$60,000 for a signed movie poster. I have a lot of signed pictures and signed movie posters, none of which are worth $64,000. And I've got some cool stuff. I remember when John Carpenter came to the Flashback convention. I was in front of his table because the staff at Flashback can like bypass the lines and go into a private room and stuff like that and get our stuff signed by some of the celebrities. I brought so much stuff. Carpenter was just like, after like 10 minutes, he's like, "Are you?" I'm like, "You're my favorite director, man. Just sign everything."
I was happy to get Ted Raimi's signature on Army of Darkness. That was nice.
Yeah, that's very cool. You know, what's one of my favorite things ever that I own is my copy, my DVD of Diary of the Dead, because it's personally signed to me, and I'm quoted on the front of the box. And I'm the only quote on the front of the box. Because nobody really likes that movie except me. And I love it. It's my second favorite zombie movie by George Romero. It goes Dawn, Diary, Night in my estimation. But yeah, I love that. I love the fact that George signed it, personalized it to me. And like right above my actual quote. It's pretty cool.
Well, I know sometimes they won't sign it unless they personalize it because they know that if it's personalized, it goes for less money.
Oh, I want it personalized.
Yeah, right.
I wanted it personalized.
Makes sense.
Yeah. The proceeds from the jacket and pants, as well as a portion of other items sold, will go to Olivia Newton-John Cancer Wellness and Research Center in Australia. Oh, okay.
That's a good thing.
Good, 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 good. Then that's a lot of money raised for that. Good. She's still fighting cancer, right? Olivia Newton-John? I know she was a survivor, but I think, and it was in remission for a while, but I think they just updated that she is battling again.
Yeah, she's from September 27th. She's battling cancer for the third time.
Yeah.
Three times. Yep. Bless her.
She's awesome, Olivia Newton-John. I always had an issue with the ending of Grease, though.
I think everybody should have an issue.
Because, like, in order for her to be accepted, she's got to become a slut. You know what I mean? She's got to dress like a slut.
Well, it's just like
I've always.
It'd be different. It'd be different if she wanted to be that way.
Right.
It seems like she's just like, no, change for people, and then they will accept you.
Right, and then the car flies away.
I didn't like how. honestly, the thing that bothered me the most is that all of a sudden, what's her name's not pregnant.
Oh right,
what's her
Stalker Channing?
Yeah,
yeah.
She's just not pregnant. Oh no, everything's cool. Team pregnancy avoided.
Yeah. And she was like 35 when they made that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
That's everybody in that movie is supposed to be a teenager, and they were all like in their 30s when they made it.
It's like The Blob.
It's crazy. Yeah, exactly. The original version of The Blob. Steve McQueen was 50 when he made that movie, I think.
It's like, look at the muscle tone on these teenagers.
Yeah.
What is that?
Crazy. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll jump back into it and talk about the most expensive movie collectibles. And if you have any collectibles sitting around, 312-981-7200. Snoop.
D-O-double-G.
Yeah, man. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you want to join us, welcome back to 2 for Tuesday. Here. 312-981-7200. We're talking about the most expensive movie collectibles of all time, and if you have some collectible stuff and you want to join us, talk or text us at 312-981-7200. Here's Louise on WGN. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
My roommate has an LP, and it's called Mr. Spock's Music from Outer Space. It's from Star Trek.
Yeah.
And Leonard Nimoy actually sings a song on there, and it's autographed by Leonard Nimoy.
Wow.
Yeah. And her dad used to work for the Tribune, so she's very...
Wow.
She got it from the reviewer or something, and they gave it to her dad. So... autographed by Leonard Nimoy. How
very
about
cool.
that, huh?
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Louise.
You're welcome.
Take care. Yeah, man. Leonard Nimoy, quite a singing career.
Surprising.
Bilbo Baggins. It's a jam.
I had a friend who, I had a friend who for her school's talent show, her and her entire family went up in front of the school and did the, like, what's it called? Like, the Ballad of Bilbo,
Baggins. Yeah.
They did it beginning to end.
Outstanding.
Like, with all the instruments and, like, a washboard and his
outstanding.
Xylophone.
Outstanding.
It's remarkable stuff.
Oh, I love it. Got some texts here. 312-981-7200. Joliet Mike says, I have a copy of the script from the table read for the pilot episode of Coach. It's signed by the entire cast. Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. 815 area code says, from flashback weekend last year, I have a hockey mask signed by the five actors that played Jason from the Friday the 13th series, including Steve Dash, who played Jason in part two and sadly passed away a few months later. He did? Steve Dash passed away? I did not know that. One of the pictures that's up on the glass of our office is me with the five Jasons.
Yeah, he died last December.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. No. Yeah, I got a picture. I got a picture of me with all the five Jasons trying to kill me. It's pretty cool. I just realized that I think the celebrity on the wall that I have that on that glass wall that we have where I put up all the pictures that I get at flashback, the celebrity that I have the most pictures with is Robert Englund. There's like five pictures of me with Robert over the year because he's been to Flashback like 800 times.
Right, right.
And, you know, you always want to get a picture with Robert Englund. He's a ham, and he always wears the damn glove. He poked me in the neck with it 1 year. Like, that, those things are sharp. He poked me in the neck when they were taking a picture. He went, and I was like, ow, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry. Got a little carried away, Freddy. All right, what about this? Most expensive movie collectibles. And we want to, if you got any collectibles or anything like that, we want to hear from you. Stories and all that cool stuff. 312-981-7200. Indy's hat from Raiders of the Lost Ark. With four Indiana Jones movies under his belt, Harrison Ford and his iconic adventure have survived many a scrape, often reaching for and snatching the character's signature fedora out of harm's way just in time. Given how important Dr. Jones is to movie fans, it's no surprise that his hat to them is what the is like the Ark to the archaeologist. One of Ford's hat from the first Indiana Jones adventure, Raiders of the Lost Ark, recently sold at an auction in 2018 for $424,000. $424,000.
You're going to wear that? You know, what do you do with that?
Other popular props from Indy's ensemble obviously include his whip, gun holster, leather jacket, and the Sankara stones from Temple of Doom. Do they light up? Will they burn? Will they burn through you? They should have, like, the heart that gets ripped out of the guy's chest.
That'd be awesome.
In Temple of Doom.
Imagine having that on your mantelpiece.
I remember when that movie came out, there was so much controversy about the violence in it, and it came out the same summer as Gremlins. Both of them are rated PG. Those are the two movies that are responsible for the invention of PG-13. Because people were like, what are you doing, Steven Spielberg? What is happening here? You know, like the guy who was like Mr. E.T.
Yeah,
you know, all of a sudden, 2 years later, he releases two movies. Well, he didn't direct Gremlins, but he produced it. And Temple of Doom is ripping hearts out and stuff.
Killing guys with shish kebabs.
And alligators. Remember the guy falls all the way down the thing and then gets chewed up by an alligator?
Yeah.
Golly, and then in Gremlins, man.
Gremlins is
dark. Yeah, so that's why PG-13. You know what the first PG-13 movie ever?
What?
Red Dawn.
That's only PG-13?
The original. The original Red Dawn. Not the stupid remake, but Red Dawn.
Yeah, that movie, I would have maybe got a little harder. And I like Red Dawn. I have Red Dawn.
I love that movie.
But like within the first, 15 minutes, there's a kid that gets just mowed down. He's dead in the window. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, PG-13. First PG-13 movie was Red Dawn. Second one was The Woman in Red, the Gene Wilder movie with Kelly LeBrock. And the third one, which came out a week later, was Dreamscape. With Dennis Quaid and Kate Capshaw. Have you ever seen Dreamscape?
I have not seen
Dreamscape. Oh, my God, you have to see Dreamscape.
But Kate Capshaw's in it.
No, 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 no. You have to see. You've got to see Dreamscape. It is a great movie. It's a great movie. Third PG-13 movie ever. But no, you got to see. Man, I insist you see Dreamscape. Joseph Rubin directed it. It's
Max von Sydow?
Yeah, man, you got to see it.
Well, if Max von Sydow's in it, I'll watch it.
And Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid rules.
Close your eyes, then the adventure begins.
It's great. Great. All right, let's take a quick break. We got more expensive movie collectibles to talk about, and we want to hear from you, too, at 312-981-7200. The news is up after this.
I feel it's now or die. I have itchy fingers. Butterflies are strange.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about things that all Chicagoans should know, but right now we're talking about most expensive movie collectibles. Who requested the Frampton?
It's coming to us from our old pal Squat.
Squat wanted to hear a little Frampton. All right. Legally, in the 70s, you had to have Frampton Comes Alive or you could be arrested. You had to hone that album. So, God, he was big in the 70s with his hair. All right. We are talking about the most expensive movie collectibles and collectibles in general. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. The white dress from the seven-year itch. That shot of Marilyn Monroe in the seven-year itch standing above a subway grate is one of the most iconic images in cinema history, with one of the most with one of Hollywood's biggest stars sporting one of the most unforgettable costumes. That very white dress with a very deep V-neck cut also has the distinguishment of being the most expensive costume from a movie ever sold at auction. Previously owned by actress Debbie Reynolds, Monroe's dress sold in 2011 for more than $1 million. I remember when Debbie Reynolds owned it. $1 million for that dress. How about the Aston Martin DB5 from Goldfinger? Monroe holds the record for most expensive costume ever auctioned off, but when it comes to the most expensive piece of movie memorabilia, that belongs to, shocker, Bond. James Bond and 007's many spy gadgets, of them, is the most coveted is the Aston Martin DB5 from Goldfinger. Sean Connery drove the car in his best Bond movie, and two DB5s were used in the making of Goldfinger. The effects car, quote-unquote, was the one rigged with the machine gun, taillights, and revolving license plates. And the road car was used for regular driving. One sold in 2010 for $4.6 million. It's a cool car.
I love that car.
I had a little Matchbox version of it.
Yeah.
And a bigger one, too, because you could flip the guns would pop out of it. Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty great movie car.
It's too bad that the gadgets probably aren't actually functional.
No.
No oil slick, no fog machine or whatever.
The racing suit from Le Mans. When movie fans think of Steve McQueen, they likely picture him either rocking his black turtleneck and Mustang from Bullet or his famous race car driving suit from 71's Le Mans. For fan Timothy Davies, in the UK, the latter was his favorite and a highly priced collectible. Only three suits survived the making of Le Mans, with one finding its way to Davies' hands when he won it at age 12 via a competition in the local newspaper. What? That's a heck of a prize. While we'd be hard-pressed to part with movie history like this, the $984,000 it went for in the 2011 election would soften the blow. Almost $1 million. A Velociraptor from Jurassic Park. What? You can't think of dinosaurs without simultaneously thinking of Jurassic Park. Steven Spielberg's 1993 blockbuster adaptation of Michael Crichton's sci-fi bestseller came out as CG was in its early days, so the production had to create a fair share of physical dino props to have on set. One of the most popular creations out of Stan Winston's special effects shop was the Velociraptor. One of the dinos clever enough to open doors and outsmart the electronic fences around the paddock scored an impressive $77,000 at a 2009 auction. So is it going to be like 5 feet tall?
I hope so. Have a little Velociraptor in my house. That'd be cool.
Yeah. Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet. The Tempest in Space. Forbidden Planet is dated but solid 1950s sci-fi outing starring Leslie Nielsen opposite one of cinema's most instantly recognizable robots ever, Robbie. The original 7-foot-tall creation, pre-CGI obviously, is catnip for movie collectors. It sold for, are you sitting down, $5.3 million in 2017. Whomever the buyer was, their name was never disclosed. They sure hit pay dirt with their winning bid. The lot Robbie was in also included the GP drives in the original MGM packing crates. Charlie Chaplin's Cane from Modern Times. For audiences, silent cinema star and silver screen legend Charlie Chaplin was inseparable from his on-screen persona dubbed the Tramp. His signature top hat and cane helped forge a look whose silhouette alone is instantly recognizable. That kind of notoriety is priceless, but the cane Chaplin used in his 1936 classic Modern Times came with a price tag. The iconic actor's iconic cane went up for auction in 2013. One lucky buyer was able to add it to their collection for $350,000. I don't know why that seems low to me. You know what I mean? Judging by how much some of this other stuff is worth, that's Charlie Chaplin's cane.
Robbie the Robot went for millions.
Yeah. Well, he's Robbie the Robot. So. Han Solo Carbonite from Return of the Jedi. Sideshow Collectibles have been making fans drool and lament their bank account's low balances ever since they launched their line of high-end movie collectibles. One of their most coveted and costly pieces is a life-size Han Solo Frozen and Carbonite figure. Star Wars fans know how Han got turned into a frozen, scruffy-looking Nerf herder. Thanks, Lando. And they wish they had almost $75,000 to offer owning this replica. Maybe if they pull off a Lando and make a deal with Vader, they can swing a few extra bucks. $7,500 for the Carbonite, for Han Solo and Carbonite. And it's not, it wasn't used in the movie. That's just a, it's a replica.
That's a replica?
The Sideshow Collectibles is what you were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. That's what they offer. $7,500.
It makes you wonder where the actual one is.
Yeah.
It'd be floating around somewhere.
Wait, could you imagine that's a life-size thing? Where are you going to put it?
I don't know. Somewhere where everyone can see it. Pay that much money?
God. The black dress from Breakfast at Tiffany's. If you haven't seen Breakfast at Tiffany's yet, you're living a life wrong. The iconic film starring Audrey Hepburn, perhaps one of the most iconic dresses to ever appear on the silver screen. It's Hepburn's legendary black dress that she wore while window shopping at Tiffany's in 1961. It's as unforgettable as Hepburn's performance. It hit auction in London, expecting to fetch at least $138,000 from prospective bidders, but auctioneers and attendees' jaws figuratively dropped when the dress managed to sell for over $800,000 in 2006. $800,000. All right, here's Tom on WGN. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a album that I got when I worked at a record store. I went in their basement and I found it down there. It's a bootleg Jimi Hendrix album recorded in Hamburg, Germany around 1966.
Hmm. So you found it in the record store? Do you know how much it's worth? Do you know how much it's worth?
No, I haven't. I have no idea even how to find out.
Ah, okay. We can do some research online maybe and try and figure out how much it's worth. That's pretty cool. Okay, thanks, Tom.
It's never been opened.
Never been. Oh, okay. You haven't even listened to it.
Nope.
Okay. Well, you got to find out how much it's worth, Tom. I would do some research online.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks, Tom.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. 312-981-7200 for talk or text. We're talking about collectibles and most expensive movie collectibles. Ike from Country Club Hills says, I haven't bought it off eBay yet, but they have the actual Mission Impossible explosive gum from the first movie for like $22. I don't think I even remember the explosive gum from the first movie.
That's, if he's talking about the Brian De Palma one, that's when he throws it, I think he like throws it at a fish tank.
Oh, right,
remember?
Right.
And he's sitting there, and that's when he realizes he's being set up as a patsy.
Yeah.
That's, oh God, that's so good.
Yeah. All those movies are good.
Yeah.
They're all good.
But I've got a super soft spot for the De Palma one because it's just, the story makes almost literally no sense.
Yeah.
And,
there's so many great set pieces in it.
It's just crazy.
I mean, obviously, where he infiltrates the CIA headquarters is one of the, it's fantastic and iconic. The final action sequence on the train.
Yeah.
Crazy. But I mean, my favorite one was the last one.
Yeah,
what the hell, Fallout?
Yeah, Fallout.
Oh man,
Fallout was nuts. It was nuts.
It's crazy how these movies. The only one that I don't think is great is the John Woo one. Oddly enough,
mm-hmm.
It's good. It's really good, but it's not as good as the rest of them. The J.J. Abrams one rules, and then McQuarrie just really has knocked them out of the park. Now,
yeah, he's taken over.
Oh, there's no question about it.
I'm so glad that they keep bringing him back because it's just like he's become a
great action director, and I'm telling you I saw that last one. I saw it twice in the theater, both times in IMAX.
Can't even imagine.
I mean, please. And there were sequences that were shot specifically for IMAX, like the helicopter chase and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Only time I've ever liked what's his face, Superman face.
Oh, Henry Cavill.
Only time I've ever liked him. And that fight in the bathroom,
super cool,
with the Asian dude.
Yeah.
Oh, knocking down walls and stuff and whipping each other through sinks.
You know, for Mission Impossible 2, the villain Duggery Scott turned down being Wolverine to take that role.
Oh, no.
Missed out.
Wow. Hey, Nick, I own the black-rimmed hat that was used in the movie Father Goose. I was fortunate to meet Cary Grant, and it was 1979, and that's how I came to receive it. I got it signed, and I have a nice little note from him. I keep it in a vacuum seal frame. It's very, very cool. Meeting Cary Grant, bar none, was the best. A great actor and a really nice guy. Cary Grant's one of my favorite actors on the planet, ever, in the history of anything. I love Cary Grant. Guy could do anything. He could do anything. He could play romance. He could play drama. He could do thriller. And, of course, comedy. Like, he was top-notch at comedy. His Girl Friday is a movie I watch monthly. One of the greatest movies ever made. And you watch that movie, and you're astonished by the timing of it. And, like I watch it, and I'll feel breathless. I'm not even talking.
Wasn't there a bit where he confuses an old man for
purposely. He does it purposely.
Yeah, that's so
nice to meet you. And he shakes he shakes his hand. Ralph Bellamy's standing behind him, going what? and then of course you know he says Archibald Leach at one point. That's his real name. And then he says that fellow out there because she keeps her fiance waiting outside. Ralph Bellamy. Rosalind Russell keeps him out in the lobby when she gets to the newspaper office to talk to Cary Grant, and he says to his assistant, "Go out there get that fellow out there and bring him back here." Yeah, he looks like that actor Ralph Bellamy. He actually says that, and it's Ralph Bellamy. Only Cary Grant could get away with stuff like that. He's the best. All right, let's break here for some weather, and we'll come back and we'll wrap up this conversation about expensive movie collectibles. And then we're going to talk about things that every Chicagoan should know. That's coming up after the news, which is coming up a little bit later on. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah!
312-981-7200. That's the phone number if you want to join us. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, the great Steve Cochran at 6. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We've been talking about some expensive movie collectibles here, and if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. How about this? The Lead Falcon from the Maltese Falcon. The Maltese Falcon is amongst the most must-have of movie collectibles. It first appeared in the classic 1941 film The Same Name, starring Humphrey Bogart as intrepid detective Sam Spade on the trail of his coveted object. A number of plaster variants of the prop were used in the movie and have emerged among collectors who think it is the hero prop used in the movie. But a Lead Falcon, clocking in at 45 pounds, sold at auction in 2013 for $4.1 million. After 80 years, fans will never know which Falcon is the OG one. $4.1 million. The Purple Coat from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Gene Wilder's portrayal of the eccentric maker of chocolate and keeper of the Oompa Loompas is permanently etched into our collective brains. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was essential childhood viewing. The only thing more iconic than Wilder's performance is his character's signature costume. Wonka's purple suit coat with frilled shirt belonging in the Hollywood memorabilia equivalent of the Louvre. In 2012, one lucky fan managed to snag it. Like it was one of the coveted golden tickets and added to their personal collection, the entire outfit sold for $73,800. How about an everlasting gobstopper from Willy Wonka? Speaking of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, props from Warner Brothers' children's movie are highly coveted by movie collectors, especially Wonka's most popular invention. No, not his candy bars, though five of those sold for $17,000 recently. We're talking about the everlasting gobstopper. Only two of the multicolored candy props are known to exist. The first fetched $42,500 at auction in May 2011, enough to make that spoiled brat Veruca Salt blush. The second, kept by the actress who played Veruca, sold from the collection for $40,000. Lightsaber from Star Wars. I bet these go. These got to go for a lot of money. They got it, right?
Totally.
A lightsaber? I mean,
if you can get an original one, yeah. No doubt.
Last seen being split in half after Rey and Kylo Ren's tug-of-war in Star Wars The Last Jedi, Luke Skywalker's lightsaber has been around ever since Mark Hamill first wielded it in 1977 Star Wars. The hero prop was made from an old camera tube, and a wooden pole was used for a blade during filming, but the prop sold for more than its parts. In 2008, Luke's laser sword, given to him by Obi-Wan, ended up in the hands of one lucky fan for $450,000. Lightsaber hilts are big deals for Star Wars collectors, even those from lesser movies. Liam Neeson's lightsaber from 1999, Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, was auctioned off for $66,000. Come on, man. A prop from Phantom Menace goes for $66,000? How much is Jar Jar going to go for?
Well, they'd spend the money just so that they could like burn the suit,
like,
or something.
Erase him from the film.
I'd take the Liam Neeson lightsaber, though. Liam Neeson's awesome in that movie.
Yeah. He's the best thing in the movie. He's the best thing in the movie.
What about Ewan?
I thought that movie was terrible, man.
I mean, it is, but...
But I saw it when I was seven. I thought Liam Neeson was the best thing in the movie. And I will say this. The lightsaber battle with him and Darth Maul is pretty badass. I will say that. I just like when he isn't there a part? Because I've only seen Phantom Menace once, but I've seen that scene a couple of times because I like it.
Yeah, when you
doesn't he just like stop at one point and just like meditate, or like Liam Neeson just stops like a badass and just stands there?
Yeah, because they get stuck in like this force field, right, sort of thing. So he can't move. So he gets down, he meditates. Yeah, and
that was badass, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hey, what's up, Nick?
Hey, what's going on?
I've got, believe it or not, I found this at Goodwill. I've got the original poster from Operation Petticoat with Tony Curtis and Cary Grant on it. And I'm freaking out. I think I picked up for a couple bucks. I was like, wow, somebody letting this go.
Wow, yeah. No, that's a bit. You know what's really funny about Operation Petticoat? Tony Curtis was the star of that movie. And then they made a series out of it, a TV series out of it in the 70s, in the late 70s. And you know who was on the series as a regular?
Who?
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Ah.
Little piece of trivia for you, starring in one of her dad's TV movie versions of her dad's movie.
So was it also called Operation Petticoat?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was. Hey, Rich, thanks for the call, man. How about the Cowardly Lion costume from The Wizard of Oz? It's an undisputed Hollywood classic. Its Technicolor trip through Oz gave birth to many iconic moments and scenes where props and costumes are high collectors on their must-have list. The Cowardly Lion costume worn by Burt Lahr in the 1939 film was one of them. Oz's costume designer spared no expense in bringing the popular character to life. It was made out of real lion hides. What?
That's a move. That's a move right
what?
There.
What? Which led to it weighing almost 60 pounds and being crazy hot to wear under the soundstage lights. It sold at New York auction for $3 million. How much weight you think Burt Lahr lost? A 60 pound costume under the stage lights?
Oh, man. Can't even imagine. Take that, put that on and go to the gym.
Man,
he'll drop weight.
Man, oh man.
Get that lion body.
The white suit from Saturday Night Fever, famously a local story here. If movie critic Gene Siskel were still alive, he would probably wish he'd had the cash to purchase this fixture of his favorite movie. It really was his favorite. In Paramount's smash hit Saturday Night Fever, struggling dancer turned disco king Tony famously strutted in his white suit to the Bee Gees in the most memorable and iconic scene. He did so atop this colorful light-up dance floor, which sold in 2017 for $1.2 million. But Siskel owned the white suit.
Yeah, famously.
Yeah, he owned the white suit. about the spacesuit from Alien. The one that Ripley wore?
Mm-hmm.
Like at the end?
I think so, yeah. I think that's the one.
How about the brainwave analyzer from Back to the Future?
Christopher Lloyd. Yeah.
They also have a hoverboard from Back to the Future Part 2 that you can get.
I would want that in my house.
The hoverboard goes for $28,000. The brainwave analyzer went for $70,000.
Oh, I can retire at 78.
Sure. All right. Well, there you go. Some crazy movie props that are worth a lot of money. Listen, when we get back after the news, we are going to talk about things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. And that'll be coming up after the news.
Meet you downstairs in the bar and her. Your rolled up sleeves in your skull t-shirt. You say, why did you do with him today? And sniff me out like I was Tanqueray. Cause you're my fellow, my guy.
All right, welcome back. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. I'm your overnight dude, 1 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. We're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's 2 for Tuesday. And who requested that?
You know what? I did not get a chance to put down their name, but they did request. I got the two songs, a couple of Amy Winehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're still out there, listen, shoot us a text so that I can give you proper credit.
Okay. Speaking of Amy Winehouse, my my lovely future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo, used to do a Amy Winehouse tribute show here in Chicago.
I imagine. She's a dead ringer.
Yeah. Yep. And she can sing, too. So, but she's a massive Amy Winehouse fan. My future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo. I love her. She's the best. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Hey, we're going to talk about things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. What do you think? What do you think there are things that people from Chicago absolutely should know how to do? 312-981-7200 for talk or text. 312-981-7200. How long have you lived in Chicago, Tom?
So I started coming here for school in 2012. So I guess technically I lived in the dorm for a couple years. So I think I got my first apartment.
And you went to Loyola, right?
I went to Loyola. So I was up in Rogers Park. So I didn't have my own place paying rent, you know, until 2014.
Okay.
So I've been here since 2014. I stayed in Rogers Park for a few years, and then now I live in Uptown.
Mm.
So basically North Side.
Yeah.
But my mom and her side of the family have been out on the Northwest Side since probably the early 60s, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
But you're from Crystal Lake originally.
From Crystal Lake. I was, born in Chicago, born at Northwestern Hospital, lived next to my grandma for a very brief amount of time, and then ended up, traveled a little bit around, lived in Scotland for a period of time, and then moved to Crystal Lake in 1995.
Okay.
I was quite young.
So there you go. Yeah, you were two.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I, as people who are regular listeners to the of the show know, that I grew up here in Chicago. I've never lived anyplace else. I wouldn't want to live anyplace else than this city. Grew up just blocks away from Wrigley Field. Have lived on the Northwest Side most of the time. And been a part of this city for a long time. For my whole life, I've been here. At a very early, early age, I began riding the L and making my way downtown. And my parents, when I was a kid, would take me everywhere. Like, we would go everywhere. And my father was also a guy who, when I was a kid, he wanted to take me to as many different movie theaters as possible because he knew how much I loved movies. So we would vary it up, and we would end up going to movie theaters that weren't in our neighborhood, or, you know, just to go to as many movie theaters as possible. That was like, so we would do that. And I went to a ton of different movie theaters when I was a kid. And I knew the city really well. So I've grown up here, went to public school, public elementary school, right by, not very far from Wrigley. Alexander Hamilton Grade School is where I went. At on Paulina and Cornelia, right down the street from St. Andrew's Church and school. So I've been in Chicago in my whole life, and this article here, which was in the Chicago Tribune by Ernest Wilkins, talks about 25 things that Chicagoan should know how to do. Every Chicagoan should know how to do. So we're going to go through these, and if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Here's Mike on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How are you?
All right. What's up?
Every Chicagoan should know how to use lower Wacker Drive to navigate around the traffic of the loop.
You know, that's a good one.
And about a year ago, there was some controversy that some cell phone company wanted to come in and put cell phone towers down there so people could use their GPS. And I'm like, I think it's a terrible idea. Like, Lower Wacker Drive is one of those secrets that just Chicagoans should know about.
Yeah.
You don't need a bunch of goofy tourists down there with their GPS trying to figure out where they need to go. No. Lower Wacker Drive is for true Chicagoans only.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm with you, Mike. I like that one. Thanks, man.
You bet.
All right. You know, some people think Lower Wacker Drive is a little creepy, and it can be. It can be, especially after you see Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yeah.
You may not look at Lower Wacker Drive the same way again after seeing Henry. You may not look at a lot of the parts of the city. I remember the first time I saw that movie. We went to a special midnight show preview at the Music Box. Like five of us went during the home invasion scene where they videotape the home invasion scene. My friend Oaken had to get up and leave. He's like, I can't do it. And he got up and he walked out of the theater, came back in like 10 minutes later. He's like, I don't even know what to say about that. That scene is unbelievable. One of the most disturbing things I've ever seen in a movie. So I told you the story, right? After the movie was over, because, you know, obviously it was shot in Chicago. You know, the great John McNaughton. So, did I tell you the story about what happened afterwards? After the midnight screening?
You, like, ran into, or they came to see you or something?
No. After the movie, okay, because first of all, if you've seen Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, it is a terrifying movie. It is a terrifying movie, and it's deeply, deeply disturbing. And Michael Rooker, obviously fantastic as Henry, but Tom Tolles as Otis, one of the most terrifying performances I've ever seen. So we walk out of the movie. We're traumatized by this movie. Already, Scott had to get up and leave during one scene. We walk out of this movie. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now because we saw it at a midnight show. And we're walking out, and we're like, oh, my God. Because it really does. You know, I mean, it's an exhausting experience to see that movie. So we walk out into the lobby. There's Tom Tolles standing in the lobby, like, talking with a couple of people. And I wouldn't go near him. I just, like, I went, ah! When I visibly went, ah! When I saw him. And I was like, Otis is right here.
I'm not ready for this.
Otis is 3 feet away from me right now. I've got to get the hell out of this theater. And then eventually I've met Tom Tolles, and he was a really wonderful guy, like a really sweet guy. But yeah, so Lower Wacker Drive, everybody. All right, let's see. You start to learn things about Chicago after living here a while. Red Eye staff members feel we'd be ignoring our civic duty by not cluing you in on some of the best tips and tricks we've acquired over the collective years. Call them Chicago hacks. Here we go. Never get gouged for baseball tickets. I have employed this strategy for both Cubs and Sox games over the years. Note that it is almost never works during the big rivalry games or the Crosstown Classic, and you have a better chance of success during midweek games. One, wait for the game to start. Seriously. Post up to a bar or the tailgate. Walk up to one of the brokers, not a scalper, mind you. There's a difference. Two, lowball the crap out of them. Three, watch you some baseball. Wait till the game starts. It's good advice. It is. How about this? Work the damn grid. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to navigate around the city. We should be lucky we even have a grid system. Have you ever been to Atlanta? It's like someone got drunk off peach brandy and opened up Sim City and went for it. Here's how it works. The beginning of the grid is at Madison and State, which is why it's listed as 0 east-west, 0 north-south. All east-west streets in the city are coordinated by how far they are from State Street, ditto with the north and south streets from Madison. 800 units that city blocks for the slow kids on the grid system equals 1 mile. So let's say that you're having a few beers at Quenchers at the corner. Well, it's closed now. You can't have a few beers at Quenchers now. At the corner of Western and Fullerton. Fullerton is 2400 north. Western is 2400 west. You are 24 blocks from both State and Madison and at the center of the city. Yeah.
I have such trouble with that, though.
Do you?
I'm terrible with it.
Are you really?
Yeah.
It's really easy to get around in this city.
I know. I just have... I'm crippled with a poor sense of direction. And
yeah.
But my, and now I don't really need to know because I've got this little miracle computer that sits in my pocket and can tell me where I need to go. But my grandmother, if I tell her the cross, if I give her two cross streets, she can tell me how to get to each one, like the exact directions I would need to take. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at it too. I'm pretty strong at it too. I mean, you know, not so much with the south side, and I'd be the first to admit I have an ignorance about the south side, and it's not a prejudice or anything. I grew up on the north side, spent most of my time on the north side. How about this? How to actually get into the girl and the goat? Well, I know how. Here's an easy way. Have Stephanie Eisert on your show a couple of times. That's how I did it. if you don't have reservations, the best time to go to Stephanie Eisert's popular West Loop restaurant is right around open set. It's at 4:30 p.m. Diehards will be lining up, so plan accordingly. You'll have the choice of beelining for a bar stool or sometimes nabbing a seat at the chef's table near the kitchen if it isn't booked until 6 p.m. or later. Such a great restaurant.
I've never been. I've never had the opportunity to go.
And man, did I root for her on Top Chef. I was so happy when she won. Yeah. I had her on the show a few times, you know, and the restaurant's great. It's a great restaurant. But that's good advice. My advice doesn't seem like everybody will be able to do that.
No, that's a special, special just for you. Step one, get a radio show.
Right.
Step two.
All right, let's take a break for some weather here, and then we'll come back. What are some other things that everybody in Chicago needs to know how to do? Welcome back, everybody. Amy Winehouse. All right, do we have the person who requested that?
Yeah, and apologies again. This is Michelle from Geneva.
Michelle from Geneva, picking a little Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michelle.
All right, there you go. Two for Tuesday. Oh, yeah! 312-981-7200. We're talking about things every Chicagoan should know how to do. And this is an article that was written, it is in the Chicago Tribune. And it's just, things and advice on how you can get things done or how you can do things that you need to do because you're a Chicagoan. 708 area code says, just tuning in for this, so if it hasn't been said already, I apologize, but driving in the snow and the rain. Every Chicagoan should know how to drive in the snow and the rain. A lot of them don't. Chris in Buffalo Grove says, I used to live in the city, but I'm in the burbs now. But if you can't parallel park, get the hell out of the city. Somebody taking 15 minutes to park, and then they're like 25 feet away from the curb. 708 area code says every Chicagoan needs to try Home Run In Pizza. I think everybody's tried Home Run In Pizza, and I agree with that. I personally think that every Chicagoan should try John's Pizza from John's Pizzeria on Western, about 2000 Northwestern. The best pizza in the city, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, Home Run In Pizza, you got to try that. It screams Chicago. You've had Home Run In Pizza, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had Home Run In. I think it's quite good, but I'm partial to In Rogers Park, my favorite is always JB Alberto's.
Oh, yeah.
Good old J Balberto's,
yeah,
as we used to call it. And then on the south side, Vito and Nick's.
Vito and Nick's is great.
Super good. They were on Dean's show once. We had them come to the Presidential Towers run, and they brought like a pizza for everybody.
Yeah,
which is not great when you've just run up an entire like 10 flights of stairs, but they're amazing.
Now Vito and Nick's is great, and John's on Western is very similar to Vito and Nick's.
Yeah, I like that style.
Yeah,
it's a very good
style. The crispy thin crust. That's that's my favorite. I know that, you know, like, we're known for our deep dish. I don't like deep dish pizza. You should not use utensils when you're eating pizza. That's first and foremost.
I mean, honest, a lot of people I've talked to that have either lived in the city for a significant period of time or were born here and born and raised aren't really big fans of deep dish. And I don't know how that just became the thing. I guess because it's so unique to here.
Yeah, exactly. It's like real Chicagoans enjoy the tavern style, cut in squares. Thin crust. That's to me, that's Chicago pizza. The deep dish, you know, listen, if I have deep dish, I have Lou Malnati's. It's the best deep dish. There's no question about it that Lou Malnati's is the best deep dish. But, you know, you have, if you're a true Chicagoan, you have deep dish pizza as often as you go to Navy Pier. That's only when people are in town. When tourists are in town. Chicagoans don't go to Navy Pier. The only time I ever go to Navy Pier is if I'm going to an IMAX movie. That's right. It. I just go, hey, let's go to Navy Pier. No.
Yeah. I will say I have gotten hankerings before where I'm just like, you know what? I want like a, I don't want just pizza. I want like a pizza cake.
Yeah.
And I get a deep dish. But it's only
I got a Lou Malnati's literally 800 feet from my front door. From the front door of my apartment building.
Boom.
Like 800 feet. And I'm about 1,300 feet away from smokes, away from smoke, which is the best barbecue in the city. In the same complex with the Lou Malnati's, Potbelly's.
You're just spoiled. You're just spoiled, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, on the corner of my street, I've got a convenience store called Food Town, and they sell quesadillas.
Oh.
So take that.
All right. About a mile away, Culver's.
God, I've still never been to that Culver's.
You gotta go, man.
Well, because usually I only get Culver's when I'm traveling, you know.
Well, it wasn't available.
Yeah, what is it? It's Six Corners, right?
Yeah,
gotta get over that Culver's.
Just west of Six Corners.
Mm.
Yep. All right, here are some more things that Chicagoans should know how to do. Stay out of the cold. So you're downtown shopping, meeting a friend, or going to the dentist, and the weather sucks, no worries. The Pedway can make your walk much more pleasant. Lots of parking garages are connected to it, too. A lot of people don't know about the Pedway in the Loop. It's a great way to stay out of the terrible weather. There's also some really cool stuff down there.
Yeah, what's the deal with that hair salon? There's like a salon and spa down there.
Yeah, there's a bunch of weird things down there. But they're worth doing. I'm trying to remember. Oh, man, we've had her on the show a million times, and it's been a while. She does walking tours of the city. I feel terrible that I've forgotten her name. She's been on the show several times, and she does a Pedway walk. They'll take you through the Pedway. A lot of people, there are people that don't know that the Pedway exists.
It's shockingly convenient.
It's really cool, too. It's very cool. So, all right, how about this? Get drunk at Lollapalooza for less. This seems helpful. This is really good for an alcoholic to be talking about in the morning. Buy the wine. They give you a friggin' bottle's worth over ice. We call it the stepmom. It's a big commemorative cup for the price of three beers. So get wine when you go to Lollapalooza?
No one's going to do that.
Especially if it's really hot out. Don't you want something cold? Don't you want like a cold beer? And it's mostly 100 degrees every time Lollapalooza is in town.
And storming.
Yeah. Buy the wine. Okay. Navigate Lower Wacker. Oh, speaking of Lower Wacker, the upper level is for tourists and trolleys. If you really want to get across town fast, head underground. It was good enough for Batman. Well, the Joker was actually... Wasn't the Joker the one that was... Batman was chasing him.
Chasing him down there, yeah.
So it was the Joker. sticking his head out the window like a nut. You know, Joaquin does that same move in Joker. What's the matter with you? Like, one of the most iconic performances in, you know, in movie history, people could say Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker is the best performance. Well, I personally think Cesar Romero is my favorite Joker from the TV series.
With the makeup over his mustache.
Over his mustache, which he refused to shave. Cesar Romero, you got to love that guy. All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up, and then after the news, we'll jump back into this. Things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. You want to jump in with your thoughts, 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
As the hours turn into days, pretty soon lost in the haze. It's up to you and me, and who's to say? These could be the good old days.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive. We're back, and we are talking about things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. By the way, I want to thank the listener who called in to give us the name of, I feel terrible that I'd forgotten her name. Margaret Hicks is her name.
Mm-hmm.
She does Chicago Elevated. That's her website. She's the one who does the walking tours of Chicago and does a really wonderful Pedway tour. We got to get her back on the show. Yeah, because she does great holiday tours too. So let's get her back on the show, Margaret Hicks. Thank you to the listener who called in to remind my idiot brain dead her name. So, okay. We're talking about things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. Here we got some texts coming in. If you guys want to jump in, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 773 area code. Everybody in Chicago should know where to get a good Italian beef. Portillo's?
I'm an Al's man myself.
I like Al's. Roma's on the northwest side. You ever go to Roma's?
Yeah, I've been
Cicero
to Roma's.
Cicero and Montrose.
Good beef.
Fantastic.
Good beef. But you got to get it wet.
Yeah, always.
If you don't get it wet.
No, always.
You're not eating beef.
No, always. Al's is good. Yeah, Al's is good. There's one right down here. Not very far from where we are.
Yeah, got an Al's down here.
There's a Portillo's not very far from here either.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Al's over in like Wrigleyville, over by like the Nisei Lounge and all that area.
Yeah.
They do a great, great beef over there.
Glenn in Evanston said, everybody in Chicago should know a shortcut while heading over by Ma's.
You got to know the quick way over to Ma's house. Yeah.
Also, here's a Chicago thing, cutting through gangways. Did that all the time when I was a kid. You know, the shortcut, you got to go through a gangway. So, you know, New York, they don't have gangways. All the buildings are slammed right next to each other because they don't have alleys. That's why there's garbage on the street. They don't have alleys in Manhattan. That's why they put their garbage in front on the sidewalk.
What an inferior place.
And, hey, man, don't be saying that about New York. New York's great.
Well, I've never actually gotten to go, so.
You need to go to New York, man.
I know. I'm just terrified.
It's a great city. Sam says, hi, Nick and Tom. I was born on the south side but raised on the north side. Can I, as a true Chicagoan, root for both the Cubs and the Sox? I don't think so.
I would not fault you.
Listen, I co-wrote and directed a play called Black and Blue, which was about two brothers. One was a hardcore Sox fan, one was a hardcore Cubs fan. Now, I'm a hardcore Cubs fan. Okay? I mean, I grew up on Addison, blocks away from Wrigley. So, but here's the thing about the play that it was co-written by this guy Anthony Turnus. And he brought me the script and said, "Hey, why don't you help me write the script. We'll write it together and then you can direct it." And I'm like, "Okay, sounds great because it's right up my alley." But I had to keep telling him to stop being so pro-Cub because I wanted the play to be even-handed. I wanted it to, you know, I didn't want it to look like it was written and directed by guys who love the Cubs. So I kept telling him, I'm like, you can't, this is just a love letter to the Cubs. You can't do that. Yeah. God, that was a huge hit, that show. We were sold out. Every show was almost sold out. Every play. And it was really funny.
Did you do an interview for it on like Fox or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I've seen that. I've seen
I did,
it's
yeah.
on YouTube.
On Fox. On, yeah, I did. They had me down. And it was Luke Nellis and ex-Bear. Who oh, my God. Why am I blanking on his name? Kicker. I can't think of his name. I don't know what's wrong with
when you were on. You were on the final word, right?
Yes.
Let's see. Wow, you're rocking some serious hair.
Yeah, I did have some hair then. Yeah. It's not Tom Thayer.
Tom Waddle.
Tom. It was Waddle, right? It was yeah. Waddle, right? So anyway, it was. Yeah, we did that. It was fun. But the show was a massive hit. One of my favorite things about it was people would come in decked out, man. Full on Sox fans in their jerseys and their hats, Cubs fans in their jerseys and their hats. What was really one? There was one performance that we had where a whole bunch of Sox fans were sitting. They were sitting house left because there was a middle. There was an aisle right down the middle of the theater where the seats were, and you have to walk down that middle aisle to either sit on the right side or the left side of the theater. So a bunch of Sox fans are sitting there, and a couple of Cubs fans walk into the row to sit down, and one of the Sox fans goes, "No, no, 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 no. This is the south side of the theater. You have to sit on the other side, on the north side." And that's what happened. They were completely separated. It just was one performance. All the Sox fans were on the left side of the house, and all the Cubs fans were on the right side of the house. It was hilarious. So, all right, let's see. Avoid CTA frustration when going to a baseball game. Even when the red line isn't under construction, taking the CTA to ball games doesn't have to be a sweat fest. Sox fans take the green line to 35th. It's a 2-block walk to the cell. Cub fans take the brown line to Belmont. It's just it's 4 blocks to Wrigley, and there are bars everywhere. I used to live right off the brown line, like right at the brown line stop at Lawrence and Kimball. I lived like right around the corner from there. Always got off at Belmont and walked. Always. That's the best way to do it. The Addison Red Line stop is a nightmare.
Well, yeah. I mean, the only I would do that is, well, I mean, luckily for me, I live so close that it's only like a 20-minute walk.
Right.
So I don't even bother taking the train. But no, that's smart to get off at Belmont.
Get off at the brown line at Belmont and walk. And
if you can get to the brown line. I mean, if you go like, because if you're coming from farther north, I mean, you might as well just. I mean, you're gonna hit Addison before you can even switch over to the brown line. Like if you're coming down
well,
from Rogers Park.
Well, yeah, you know. If you're coming from Rogers Park, that's a different.
But anywhere else, yeah, get off of Belmont.
I mean, I just was lucky. I lived in Lawrence, and I lived near Lawrence and Kimball. That's the brown. That's the end of the brown line. Deal with snow, whether it be shoveling, lift your knees, driving in it, not like an idiot, please, or slogging through the snow. You have to be able to deal with it to survive our winters, usually. Well, we've already had a significant amount of snow. Thank you, Halloween. How about this? Walk with purpose.
I cannot stress this enough.
I was originally going to put use the sidewalk like you have common sense, but this works too. Walk like you have somewhere to be. Even if you don't, leave that meandering nonsense to the tourists. This goes double if you're on a bridge. Oh, God. Oh. You know, it's interesting because, you know, we work downtown. But for many years, we worked right on Michigan Avenue. And, you know, walking from a train or walking from someplace else down Michigan Avenue, either to or from the Tribune building when we used to work there, was sometimes just so aggravating. Because there were these people just like, you know, like standing in the middle of the sidewalk or just kind of meandering around. And because the Tribune building was such an iconic building and such a beautiful building, it would always have tourists in front just standing there looking up. I'm trying to get into work. I'm trying to get into the building. I'm trying to get into the building because I work there. Look, I acknowledge it was a beautiful building, you know. And yeah, I guess, you know, I took it for granted. You know, instead of stopping and looking at how beautiful the building was, I wanted to get in and go to work. And it was always like, it was always aggravating when there were people just standing out in front of the building. But yeah, just like stopping in the middle of the sidewalk. You can't, you just can't, what are you doing?
That bridge.
Which, Michigan Avenue?
The Michigan Avenue Bridge. Yeah. I could claw my eyes out. I get so frustrated with people.
I agree.
If you're there on a Saturday, because, you know, I record No Coast on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to get it. I'm trying to come across this bridge.
Yep.
And people are stopping. Oh, boy, I want to take a picture with Trump Tower.
Absolutely.
No one cares.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that really, really upsets me. I get it. It's downtown on a Saturday.
But
you want to be hanging out. You're excited to be here.
But at least don't block the entire sidewalk. You can take a picture. Just get out of the way. Let people get by if they really need to be somewhere and they're walking.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just get across the bridge. You can get a perfectly good picture next to the river if you just go across the bridge, take a ride on Wacker.
Yeah.
Or just go anywhere on Wacker. You can get some nice photos.
Yeah, we're right on Wacker right now.
Go down to the Riverwalk.
There's a Riverwalk right here. I'm looking at it right now.
It's
right
lovely.
Out the window.
Share that with your friends.
Yeah. All right, here's Carl on WGN. Hi, Carl.
Hey, you mentioned the snow. I'm mentioning Dibs.
You got
to claim your spot.
Yeah, well, I think Dibs make our city look moronic. I can't stand Dibs. Can't stand them. I am anti Dibs. So
I used to live in the city. Now I live out that where I got a garage.
Yeah, there you go. All right, thank you, Carl.
Yep.
I mean, obviously, I haven't driven in a very long time. I haven't driven in 20 years. It'll be 20 years since I've actually. Well, I mean, I haven't had a license for 20 years, but I may have used a car. I may have driven a couple of times now, but even when I drove, I never did Dibs, and I've never lived with a garage anywhere. I've always lived either on a regular street or a side street.
Mm-hmm.
Always, I can't tell you the number of cars that I've dug out. I think whenever it happens, and we get like you know there it goes across the country that we do Dibs in this city. I always just feel like we look like a bunch of morons.
Well, me and Brian Noonan have actually gotten into really exchanged words on this because I also am not a big believer in it. Although I see the other side's point. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. But I just don't think that it's a public. I mean, dude, it's a public.
It's a public street.
And where I live, parking is impossible anyway. So it's kind of a free for. It's like Mad Max Fury Road.
Here's the thing: the logic of Dibs is that okay, look, I dug my car out. All right, cool. I understand that it's hard work. You know what I mean? I have shoveled out a ton of different cars over the many years that I drove. Never once did I put a dinette set or a lawn chair out.
Dinette set.
To people do that.
They put I know.
So I've never once done it. Never once done it. I've lost parking spots because of it. Yes, of course I have. But it's a public street. So the logic of that is also like, hey, you know what? With the humidity, it's going to be 115. It's going to feel like it's 115. So, I'm going to put a dinette set because I'm parked in front of my house, and I don't want to walk because it's 115 degrees outside. Same thing. Oh, it's too hot out. This is my spot. Same thing. Nobody does that. And I know there are pro Dibs people out there right now who are probably screaming at the radio.
Well, and they believe it's the thin blue line between law and complete anarchy. I'm like, really? There's bigger fish to fry.
It just makes me nuts. It's exclusively a Chicago thing. No other climate where they get snow does that. None. Only Chicago.
It is fun for the yearly debate, though.
Yeah. I mean, it happens every year.
Every single year.
Every year. So anyway. All right, I got some weather for you, and then we'll wrap up the show. We got more things that every Chicagoan should know how to do. If you want to contribute, it's 312-981-7200.
When the last time I saw you, you wouldn't even kiss me. That rich guy you've been seeing must have put you down. So welcome back, baby.
Did we say who requested this?
No, this is coming to us from Ryan.
Oh, okay. Who is it?
It's a band called Eels.
Eels, okay.
Yeah, very good band.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday just concluded. We'll have Wildcard Wednesday tomorrow. So there you are. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We're talking about everything Chicagoan should know how to do. This is in a Chicago Tribune article. What about this one? Walk with your significant other. It's cute that you're walking around with your sweetie, but seriously, there are other people on the sidewalk. Let go if you're about to face a crowd, or if you need to go single file. It won't kill you. You probably won't break up either. Keep the heat on. It's simple. If you're the one standing by the heat lamp on the train platform, your job is to press the button on the heat lamp. Who doesn't do that? Seriously. Does somebody not do that? Oh, man. Let's see. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Carl in Jefferson Parks just sent in a text. Every Chicagoan should know how to drive over someone's dib markers and leave their vintage items jammed under their truck or tossed into presumed owner's bushes. I'm with you, man. 7738 code says, every Chicagoan should visit Bachelor's Grove Cemetery. Why not? Well, it's haunted. One of the most haunted places in the country, actually. 630 area code says, every Chicagoan should know how to avoid the Hillside Strangler. All right. How about this? Find a good apartment. Brokers are good. Padmapper Craigslist is better, but true Chicagoans know you have to walk through the neighborhood you want to live in to find the best places. They're usually owned by some old guy who hasn't learned how to use the internet yet.
That's how I found mine.
Is it?
Yeah, when I was first living in Rogers Park, just kept walking around until I found somewhere that seemed good. And they had, you know, the price was right, had what we needed. Bing, bang, boom.
Wow. Ride the water taxi. $2. Takes you from Michigan Avenue at Tribune Tower to Ogilvie Transportation Center. Gorgeous view, cheap price. I had a buddy who drove a water taxi.
Really?
Yeah.
What's that? I wonder what that life is like.
He was out of Navy Pier, so his like his starting point was Navy Pier, and it was like a water taxi tour thing.
Okay, yeah.
And he would lie to people about the design of buildings and stuff. He would just make stuff up.
This is a Swedish architect.
Yeah,
that's like when, IKEA.
It's like when Kramer has got the hansom cab.
Yeah,
and he's telling people lies about Central Park. he says Joe Pepitone. Yes, yeah. This was designed by Joe Pepitone.
Can you take the water taxi to Chinatown?
I don't think so.
Oh, man.
All right, how to drink like a Chicagoan. Rules are simple. Handle your booze, handle your bill, and handle your business the next day. There's a lot of drinking on this thing. Own your neighborhood summer fest. There's a fest on your street. Fantastic, because that means the liquor stores in the corner will almost jack up the price of canned beer by the night or the week before so you don't get gouged. Get bleep done in your neighborhood. Got an issue? Find out what ward you live in. Hurry, they might have changed them again. That's true. Whenever it's convenient. Yeah, let's just change the ward. Know your alderman? Get all up in his or her grill. Repeat as needed until the problems are solved. Embrace alternative grocery shopping. This I love. From farmers markets to produce trucks to bodegas, a real Chicagoan should know where to get good groceries without ever having to set foot in a chain store. Drink at the Billy Goat right. Look, the goat is a wonderful thing, but rules are rules. And if you ask for fries, you're going to look like an idiot. Chicago regulars do know that at the Goat, if you know your bartender and tip well, every shot is in the house is $5, and you'll likely get a double. There is an excessive amount of drinking tips on this.
Yeah.
Do we really drink that much? I mean, I used to. But, wow. Find a secret party. Chicago is like that Houdini song. The freaks come out at night. Now social media has made it easier trying to find the secret 7 a.m. rager. But you've got to put some work in. Making friends with local DJs and folks in the restaurant nightlife industry would be my advice. If anything, there's always interesting people at whatever function you attend anyway.
And luckily, we've got Casera, we've got DJ Cashera. That's our in, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll get you back into the raves.
How to get high the right way. Don't ever, ever take your out-of-town friends to the Sears Tower. Every true Chicagoan knows that if you've got to take them to something touristy, you suck it up, pop for a $14 martini at the Signature Lounge, and enjoy a much better view at the top of the Hancock. And then finally, make a cocktail that tastes good using Malort. See, what? Get your cocktail shaker and put in one of the following. 1 ounce Malort, 1 ounce gin, 2 good squeezes of lemon juice, and then fill the rest with grapefruit juice and ice. Shake it, drink it, and you're welcome. That sounds reasonably disgusting to me, and I was a Malort drinker. It's the grapefruit juice that I mean. The Malort's fine. So, yeah, I used to do Malort was my shot of choice way before it became hip. Because when I first moved into Andersonville, Simon's bar, because it's Swedish, was one of the only bars that served Malort. And I remember I went in and they were like, you have to try this. It's called Malort. And they're like, you're going to hate it the first time you try it. You're going to hate it.
But you'll learn.
No, it takes 3 shots. It says so on the label. It says, but the first one, you'll hate it. The second one, you'll hate it. But by the third one, we'll have you. And it's absolutely true. The first night I ever had a shot of Malort, I was like, oh, my God. This is the most disgusting thing I've ever tasted. And I tried a second one. And by the third one, I was like, okay.
I guess we're on board.
Yep. And now the hipsters drink it. So, all right. Let's break here. Tomorrow, Kevin Powell is going to be with us, right?
Yes.
Talking
yes.
sports. We got Wild Card Wednesday and Know Your Onion.